JTAG, we have had major virtual forums on additive manufacturing, laser coating removal. We've had forums on laser shot peening for different applications, alternate energy, battery technology, chrome 6 replacement, conversion, and better plating technologies, to mention other things as well. So we're focusing on a broad range of maintenance and sustainment technology capabilities that, again, can have a substantial impact in our community. Today, obviously, we're going to be talking about cold spray. And in order to kind of couch this in the at the stratospheric level, what I can tell you is that the cost of maintenance on an annual basis approaches $80 billion annually, and it has been about that level for about the last decade. Of that, $23.4 billion the department spends on corrosion prevention control and remediation of corrosion kind of things. And if you want to look across the United States, the number that's presented by NACE, which is the National Association of Corrosion Engineers, is about $500 million annually goes toward corrosion prevention, control, and remediation. So if we break down just the DOD's portion of that $23.4 billion annual bill for corrosion prevention and control, about $3.6 billion of that goes to replacing parts during maintenance and replacing them because the cause has been determined to be corrosion on those parts. So as we look at the opportunity that cold spray technology brings to the table, we're really addressing a myriad of costs, and it really kind of starts with that $3.6 billion bogey, and it kind of builds up from that perspective, because we're not then also talking about the wear and some of the other failure modes that make parts unserviceable during the maintenance process. So the opportunity that cold spray provides us is an opportunity to reclaim and reuse more parts than we do today, and also to do a better job at protecting the parts that we're replacing from wear and corrosion. Now, traditional methods such as paints and thermal sprays have downsides. The downsides for paints are that they're not as tough. They tend to blister or peel or wear off, and they generally don't provide the kind of galvanic protection that some of the metal coatings can provide. Thermal sprays, although have fantastic application, have limited application due to the temperature of the substrate material, the portability of the equipment, the environmental and health concerns, quality issues with the melt process, a whole myriad of issues kind of again deter us from reclaiming, reusing some of the parts that may be flame sprayed, which again brings us back to the opportunity that cold spray provides. Cold spray is also known as kinetic spray metal deposition, and we've been working on that for about the last two decades across the Department of Defense, either whether you're talking about the CTMA program, or if you're talking about what's going on with ARL or AFRL or NRL or NAVAIR. We're all kind of working in the area of cold spray. And cold spray, again, provides us a lot of advantages. Where thermal spray, we're relying on droplets that impact and solidify on the surface, that's a process that's really hard to control. And the downsides to it are, process control, temperature, oxidation, those kinds of things, again, prevent us from applying thermal spray to a lot of the things that we would like to apply it to reclaim those parts. But in cold spray, when we see medical particles deforming plastically upon impact and cold welding to the surface, we get better, more uniform adhesion, we get more uniform material properties, we get less oxidation, better process control, and potential portability for in-situ repair of items as they exist on the weapon system. And so, you know, again, all the great work at ARL and NAVAIR, AFRL, and within the systems commands have brought us to a place where we're using cold spray in a fairly widespread posture across the DoD, and we've even recently issued a MIL standard 2031 that talks about how to do it and what the parameters are for doing it. But the objective today really is to kind of generate more of a unity of effort around cold spray. And again, as the JTAG charter says, and as Vic will get into with his Cold Spray Action Team charter, we're really talking about exploring and leveraging joint venues such as the CSAT and the JTAG to generate that unity of effort and facilitate that unity of effort, and to develop a community-wide roadmap and requirements, not a NAVAIR roadmap and requirements, not an Army roadmap and requirements, but what's the joint roadmap and requirements for more widespread adoption, maybe even more efficient and effective and expedient transition of cold spray in the areas where it can benefit the department, and to join our forces to create leverage then in obtaining the required resources that we need to drive cold spray further, faster than we are today, and share in one another's successes going forward. So again, that's kind of what we're trying to accomplish by bringing Cold Spray and the Cold Spray Action Team and this Cold Spray community together with JTAG to create that kind of unity of effort. And so with that, I'll hand it off to Deb Lelou, who's going to now talk about the rules of the road for today's forum, and then we'll move on to the meat and the heart of what we're going to talk about today with Vic and his Cold Spray team.
Hi, thanks, Greg. I just want to welcome everyone, and just to reiterate, our forum today is going to be via DCO, and we have an audio teleconference line established for this afternoon. In the upper left-hand corner, you will see Submit Questions Here. This is where, if you have a question that you'd like to address to any of the speakers, please type your question in there. The reason why we do that is to minimize a disruption during the forum, and in the prior forums that we've done, this actually works very well for us. Also, we're able to document all the questions. If there are any technical difficulties, please call Phil Callahan, and his number, if you guys just want to jot it down, and we can post it in the information, and it's going up there in a minute, but it's 734-260-3724, and we'll put that in the notes as well. And we also have his email address, too, that they're typing in as I'm talking. Just to also reiterate, there was a question that was raised early on. NCMS will be advancing the slides, so please, when you want to move to the next slide, just let us know. We'll take care of that. What is very, very important, in order to minimize disruption, as you know, there's a number of participants on the line. We're expecting up to 60 folks that are going to be calling in today. Please keep your phone on mute, unless you are a speaker, and that's why we're using the Q&A portion on the DCO. Also want to let everyone know that the presentations that are going to be presented today are in one document. You can see it at the bottom of your screen under presentation files. You can click on that, and you can download it to your computer, as well as the video that's going to be shown as well today. And after probably in the next day or so, we will send out a list of all the participants that have participated on the forum today. So that's all I have, and I'm going to turn it back over to Greg.
Thanks, Deb. So when we started talking about cold spray and JTAG as a potential forum topic for one of our monthly reviews, I started looking on Google, and I started to Google cold spray in DoD, and I would tell you that the first things that pop up, everything has Vic Champagne's name on it, from the Cold Spray Action Team to his cold spray, his Center for Cold Spray at the Army Research Laboratory. There's just a lot of literature out there, and as you look, Vic's got his thumbprint all over most of what pops up first on Google as far as cold spray and DoD. So that led me to pick up the phone and give Vic a call and start to talk to him about, you know, what was going on at the department level, or at least at the Army level, with cold spray, and then to talk about the opportunity of joining forces between what we're trying to accomplish in JTAG at the joint level and what Vic is accomplishing with cold spray at the Army level, and then really through really jointly through his leadership of the cold spray action team. So, you know, Vic was you know the obvious candidate for being the guy who was going to talk today or lead this discussion today on cold spray with the folks that he works with in NAVAIR, the folks that he works with in the Air Force specifically today. We'll talk to them and learn about what they're doing. But again, back to the objective of, you know, when we start to have these discussions today, when everybody would be thinking about, you know, what are the next steps for cold spray, and what can we as a joint group do to provide energy, and to facilitate then some of those actions going forward to, again, make cold spray something that we can all leverage, you know, jointly, as opposed to doing things in our stovepipes. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Vic. And Vic, thanks again for being here today.
Greg, I appreciate the introduction and try to live up to those statements. So as Greg indicated, cold spray has come a long way within the Department of Defense as well as within the commercial sector throughout the United States. And before I get into my formal presentation of the slides, I just kind of want to lay the groundwork. Greg did a fantastic job of introducing cold spray and, you know, some of its advantages over conventional technologies. So what I want to do today is the following. I'm briefly going to touch upon the CSAT. The CSAT has a very similar mission as the JTAG does. It's just very specific to cold spray. And we meet once a year, and some of the folks that are on this call, I'm sure, have attended one or more of the meetings that we've had. And I'm calling them meetings. I don't know what else to call them. They're not workshops. They're not conferences. They're all of the above, because it basically is a forum for exchanging of ideas, a forum for collaboration in the form of projects, large multi-million dollar programs, or just very small efforts. But more importantly, it's a means of implementing and transitioning the technology. So I more or less am charted to implement cold spray technology. I started in cold spray. I exploited the technology, which is why you see my name quite a bit, in the late 90s, actually in conjunction with Penn State. And we developed our own capability at ARL, and I kind of worked in the closet for a number of years developing, you know, very specific applications for DoD weapons platforms, which weren't privy to the public. So I kept my eye on what was going on in industry with Sandia Laboratories, with companies like K-Tech, which ran the Sandia cold spray laboratory, and, you know, some of the large players at that time were, you know, General Motors, Delphi, Alcoa, Pratt Whitney, and others, too. But the technology kind of got a black eye during that time, and I won't get into reasons why, but what I wanted to do, I saw the potential of the technology. So what I wanted to do was to work across the board with the tri-services as well as private industry. So that's what I want to make perfectly clear, is that I will explain. I have a few charts on what ARL is all about, the U.S. Army Research Laboratory, so that you get an idea of where I'm coming from. But we're not just scientists and engineers who play in the sandbox. And that's, you know, I'm sure why Greg contacted me because you only get so far doing that. Research and development, 6-1 basic and applied research is essential to move forward the technology, but you have to have a master plan. You have to have a vision for developing specifications, qualification criteria. You have to have a means of implementing this into the commercial sector. So the establishment of an industrial base within the United States was very important. And in those days, the late 90s, early 2000s, Europe and Asia were far ahead of us, very far ahead of us in cold spray technology. So at that time, I developed the ARL Cold Spray Center. And please advance to the first slide, please. Okay, so there we go. Awesome. All right. So the ARL Center for Cold Spray was established, and lo and behold, we started to work with not only Army partners, but Navy, a little bit of Air Force at that time. But more importantly, the private sector. And one of the first OEMs that, you know, basically came on board, I'm searching for a term because people had to be convinced. And part of what I want to do today is to convince you of the advancements of the technology since its introduction into the United States. So next slide, please. Yep, there we go. All right, U.S. Army Research Laboratory. So I want to concentrate on the applications development. I will tie that into the JTAG mission and the CSAT mission. And by the way, our next CSAT gathering will be on June 18 and 19th at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. And there will be announcements probably once or twice a month. And you'll be privy to that through the JTAG and also through the CSAT website. So this is a snapshot of ARL, Aberdeen Proving Ground, Army's leading materials research center. You see all the different capabilities in composites, energetic materials, coatings, and what have you. That just gives you an idea geographically of where the guy who's talking is coming from. Next slide, please. Okay, our mission, we went back way, you know, my son actually came up with this Three Stooges little cartoon there, way back to the Civil War. All right, so we made cannonballs and munitions, cannons for the Civil War. So that's how far we go back. You know, obviously we're involved in Desert Storm. I actually volunteered for Desert Storm more recently with the excursions in Iraq, Afghanistan, Humvee upgrades, water armor development. So we're here to, obviously, you see the middle picture, to make our warfighter capability as good as it can be. Next slide, please. That's kind of our makeup. Again, it's just, again, who we are. Next slide. And this is the last one. So the ARL Center for Cold Spray is important because we are leading the charge. Right? There's a lot of folks here, I'm sure, from the Navy. My good friend, Fred Lancaster, I was speaking to earlier. We have collaborated, probably early 2000s, at least early 2000s. And I will focus on one very important program today because it laid the groundwork for the adoption of cold spray into the DOD. It led to the first qualified procedures for cold spray for the Army as well as the Navy. And it led to the first DOD cold spray repair center, which is at the Fleet Readiness Center in North Carolina. And that was the result of the ESTCP program that I led for like 5 or 6 years. Next slide, please. All right. The only way that these things are successful, you know, the formation of the Cold Spray Action Team, known as CSTAT, is through the development and execution of programs. Without dollars, you go nowhere. So CSAT, we were fortunate enough to always have a large program that was a public program. I didn't have to worry about proprietary information being released. It was a public program, ESTCT. People can go to the and request a copy of the final report, which was published in 2012, because that program ran from 2005 to 2012 with the culmination of the first operating cold spray facility again in support of the Navy. So it was a Army kind of Navy program, a little bit of Air Force, Tinker Air Force Base was involved, Hill Air Force Base was involved, the PWIG, the Propulsion Engineering Working Group at Tinker was involved. So it's actually a tri-service program. You can see, I the things I want to point out on this slide, we're working, it says 120 companies, we're probably topping over 200 companies easily. But just as importantly, I want you to see that, you know, ARL developed the first cold spray process specification. Greg alluded to it earlier, MIL Standard 3021. Very important. Without specifications, without standards, without operating procedures, you're not going to transition a whole hell of a lot. We've also been very instrumental in developing new hardware, new software, new nozzles. I've invested over $12 million in powder development through SBIR programs and internal funded programs and you know, other projects and programs with private industry. And you will see the results of those efforts if and when you do attend the CSAT. I want to point out that our initial objectives were developing applications for aerospace, but we're working in conjunction with the automotive industry, petrochemical industry, medical electronics industries as well. So kind of the recipe is, you know, actually one-third of my funding comes from private industry. So I get contacted by private industry. They say, hey, I got an idea for this. You think it's going to work? And yeah, we talk about it. Sometimes I say, I don't think you got, you know, snowball or hell and chance. And other times I say, that's a great idea. So we'll do the proof of concept, process development, and then we hand it off. And hand it off to who? Well, currently I have an OSD, Office of Secretary of Defense, Mantech, Manufacturing Technology Program, whose mission it is to basically scale up and productionize and commercialize cold spray. We're in our second year. And the demonstration site, which basically will culminate in the world's most sophisticated cold spray system by far, and that will be at MidAmerica/Moog, and that is located in Webster, Massachusetts. And so the recipe is we are developing applications under that particular program, and they are being handed off, and that is a production site. So that's serving as a production site for actually DOD right now. They're processing new parts as well as repair parts. Next slide, please. All right. I felt compelled, even though maybe 90% of you know, so I won't kind of dwell on this, but you got to know what the cold spray process is, all right? It's a consolidation process. It's not merely a coatings process. So I get a little irritated with people that call it a coatings process because I'm making billets. We're producing billets. We're producing near-net shaped parts using cold spray. So that's not a coatings process. It's a consolidation process in which we're basically starting out with feedstock comprised of particulates, and I'm not saying just metal. Sometimes they're polymeric. Sometimes they're ceramic in combination with metals. So we basically accelerate these particulates at supersonic velocities, and they're entrapped within a gas stream, and that gas stream could be it could be simply air, it could be argon, it could be nitrogen, it could be helium, depending on the application and what that basically dictates what we're choosing for process parameters. So basically we're starting off with particulates and boom, accelerating them and building up either a coating or a freestanding structure. And you see some of the process parameters there. And actually, a couple of those a little bit out of date. Like, for instance, we've developed the BRC system, which we'll talk about a little bit later, that goes up to 1,000 PSI. And there are systems that go over 1,000 degrees C right now. But the important thing, and Greg pointed these things out, there's no melting of the particles, all right? So there's not a contraction, and you don't have to worry about, you know, oxidation, solidification, and contraction. We develop compressive stresses for the most part, as opposed to tensile stresses. So in comparison to, like, a lot of thermal spray methods, you know, you melt the particles, they solidify, then they contract, they want to pull away from the surface, all right? And that's why you need a very, you know, aggressive anchor tooth profile. I mean, you got to roughen up the surface. We found out with cold spray, a lot of times, you don't want to roughen up the surface. Actually, a finely polished surface is much better than a grit blasted surface, which even negates the need for some surface preparation. Like if we're doing some internal areas where there's a lot of, you know, electronic components, like in an aircraft, you know, we don't want grit flying all over the place. So that's another advantage. We're using nanomaterials, and you'll see some of the data that I'm going to provide, because the best way to show the capability is to provide data. I only have 25 minutes, so I can't go into every single test and every single data point. I'm giving you a snapshot. Next slide, please. That's why we invested in the technology, all right? Then hopefully the little cartoon's working. It's working for me. It's showing the particulates. You know, these are just particles. It's a simulation which shows the particles hitting, impacting a surface and consolidating, pancaking, and jetting out. So it's a very unique bond. You'll see sometimes when we try to, test the integrity, the structural integrity, the adhesion of the, like a cold spray repair site, all right? So whether it's a coating or whether it's the buildup of, say, a quarter or 3/8 of an inch, for instance, with our aluminum repair on magnesium, we actually pull out the substrate when we do a shear test, all right? The coating or the repair doesn't pull out. Next slide, please. All right, again, these are micrographs of the unique bond. So you see copper deposited on aluminum, and that's done purposely so that there's a nice contrast between the copper cold spray deposit and the aluminum substrate. So you see this jetting of material, and again, I'm complimenting Greg left and right. He used a lot of good terminology. He called, he referred to it as cold welding, and I have referred to it in similar fashion, like explosive bonding. All right, it's the same sort of mechanism, just on a more micro scale. Next slide, please. Okay, these are some of the advantages we've talked about already. Particles on the surface, so you're developing compressive stresses. I'm going to show some strength and hardness. I had PhDs giving me hardness and strength data that is basically 20 up to 30% greater than what could be achieved through conventional ingot metallurgy and secondary processing, and I had them redo hardness measurements, and I insulted them. I got the readings back, and I said it just can't be. But sometimes the strengths and hardnesses are a good 10, 20, up to 30% higher than what can be achieved through conventional means. Now, there's a downside with that. There's a downside. The downside is you can lose ductility. Ductility is an issue. But, again, with powder processing and synthesis, we've developed powders, for instance, aluminum powders for 6061 that have given us 7, 8% elongation. And that's with a strength of about 40 to 45 KSI. All right? That's pretty amazing. And that's no heat treatment involved. That's as sprayed. Density, we can achieve 100% density. Depends, again, what the material is, the wide selection of powders and materials. You'll see more and more powders, like, for instance, from H.C. Stark. We collaborated with them. You'll see cold spray powders from Praxair, and so they're popping up left and right. Versatility, again, Greg mentioned the fact, and I'm going to bring up the VRC system as well, because that is going to be a system that's associated with our OSD Mantec, and that's going to be proliferated throughout the DoD. It's very high pressure, high temperature, and it's a hybrid system. It's the only hybrid system available right now. And hybrid means it can be used with your hand. You can use the gun and hold it in your hand, or you can attach it to a robot. And it's on a wheeled dolly, so you can take it out in an aircraft hangar. You can take it out in the field. That's very important. Again, ease of production, you know, the obvious is no harmful fuels, you know, you're not mixing in hydrogen and oxyacetylene and stuff like that. So it's got a lot of environmental advantages, too. Next slide. All right, I've spoken to some of these points, topics, application areas already, but this just gives you kind of a snapshot of some of the different applications development that we've been conducting at ARL. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. There we go. All right. So this is what started it all off. You see a lot of, and I apologize if I've missed somebody as part of the ESTCP program. You see the program nomenclature, and that was started 2005, and it culminated, like I said, with the first cold spray repair facility at the Fleet Readiness Center, Cherry Point, North Carolina. And you'll see our major OEM collaborator was Sikorsky Aircraft at that time. And we focused on the repair of magnesium components for rotorcraft. Next slide, please. All right. Again, I have presented this. I just was at the Defense Manufacturing Conference and presented a couple of these slides. But you see the impact, all right? There's a tremendous impact in just this one application for the Department of Defense. You know, the Air Force has magnesium aerospace components as well, and we have a handful of those that we're working on in conjunction with the Army and Navy applications, which are for Black Hawk and Seahawk, but others as well. I mean, there's the 53, the H-1, as well as the UH-60. So you see the tremendous impact, now how many rotorcraft we have, how many magnesium parts per aircraft, and how much of the fleet is affected at any given time. These things are very expensive, and they're basically, you know, they're susceptible to wear and corrosion, and, you know, it's a darn shame to take off a housing that costs several hundred thousand dollars. You can't put it back on, and up until this point, there was really no good technology to fix those things. So you'll see a picture later on of me standing at Corpus Christi Army Depot in front of what I kind of term the Raiders of the Lost Ark inventory of aerospace components. The Army's smart, okay? Contrary to popular belief, they actually don't throw these things away, you know. And Fred, I'm going to apologize, but I gotta make the analogy. So the Navy throws these things away. The Army doesn't. They save them. And so what we're doing is we're recovering a lot of these components from inventory from the SAFER program. And you'll see a picture, and you'll see me in front of dozens and dozens of components. I call it the Raiders of the Lost Ark inventory, because if you remember the first Raiders of the Lost Ark, when they finally recover the Ark, they, you know, the end scene is basically they're carting away the Ark into this huge, massive warehouse. And that's what the Corpus Christi has, to house over $250 million in assets of aerospace parts. Next slide, please. And I'm going to pick up the pace. This is the first application that we focused on, UH-60 sump, and it's got a sister part for the Seahawk. You see the ROI for this particular component, but this is a magnesium a gearbox, ZE-41A, and you see the before and after shots. So you see the repair site, and you see, you know, after cold spray. Next slide, please. Okay, what I'm going to do is show a little bit of data, not too much, but so I want to, you know, I've been kind of comparing this to, you know, the cold spray deposits to rot. So here's some data that was actually generated at United Technologies Research Center by Aaron Nardi's group. And he's a collaborator with ARL as well as a bunch of other folks across the country. And, it, you know, you see the, you know, you basically see 60-61, you see it's in the rot condition. You see it heat treated to T4, T6 condition, which are normal conditions for various applications. And you see the cold spray data, you know. So you see, you know, you get a significant increase in strength, and you see a little bit of a hit in ductility. Initially, that ductility was less than 1%. Then we got it up to about 3-4%, but now we've hit in 7-8%. And that's just with process of powder and smart process development. There's no post-treatment whatsoever. Up in the upper right hand, you see some results from our 5083 work. We're doing some nano work as well as conventional 5083, and you see some of the values there, UTS of 50,000 and using nano up to 75,000. So our goal is actually, I have a large nanomaterials program, the $10 million program. I'm hoping to develop a nanostructured 5,000 series because we're looking at 5056, 5083, as well as 6061 in the nano condition, and we're hoping to go over 100,000. So next slide, please. I spoke to this already. This is called a triple lug shear test. It's an ASTM standard. You can look it up and see how it's conducted. But basically, those three rectangular sections in the upper left-hand corner are basically popped off in shear in an Instron machine, and you see the results. We're basically pulling out chunks of the magnesium. So this is 6061 cold spray deposited onto magnesium, and we pull out chunks of magnesium. Next slide, please. Okay. All right, so an overview of the accomplishments of the program as well as some recent accomplishments. I'm not going to read all of these, but basically what we're trying to do is to work with private industry, a lot of the OEMs, but a lot of mom-and-pop places too, to basically propagate the cold spray technology. But the only way to do it is development of processes, qualified procedures, standards. So you see in 2008, we introduced Mill Standard 3021. I'm working on a powder spec now that should be introduced this year. You see Sikorsky has approved it through an official internal document. You see and that's for the repair of the UH-60 sump. You see that we have Army approval in a document we call a maintenance engineering orders, MEOs, T7631, that was approved last year. And just recently, we received the Mantec Award for the work that we're doing in conjunction with MidAmerica, Moog, and a dozen other folks to develop that very sophisticated facility in Webster, Massachusetts. Next slide, please. All right, there you go. Here's my lovely face in front of the SAFER, which is basically, you see it written there, the Storage Analysis Failure Evaluation and Reclamation Center. It's basically a big, huge warehouse, and that's at Corpus Christi Army Depot in Corpus Christi, Texas, and that's me standing in front of just one little area of all. Those are all used parts waiting to come back to life, sort of say. You see some of the cold spray transition locations, okay, and you see, you know, there's some Air Force bases there. I mean, Tinker has had the capability, through the PWIG, the Propulsion Engineering Working Group, for a number of years, and, you know, they were part of the original ESTCP program. Hill Air Force Base, currently we're working on a couple of applications for them. Anniston Army Depot, Fort Hood, Corpus Christi. I mentioned the Fleet Readiness Center. I mean, there's probably dozens of others, but these are kind of the biggies that we're doing a lot with right now. And you see you know, the approval documents, the official documents, you know, for Army and Air Force. Again, without these, the technology goes nowhere. Next slide, please. Okay. So you see some of the non-structural cold spray repair processes, and I want to use that word non-structural because it's important, because I want to distinguish it from structural at this point in time. But we're hoping by the end of this year, and it's probably more than a hope because I just got recent data just yesterday from Sikorsky and United Technologies, who are basically working hand in glove with me on the structural repair, that we're probably going to have a structural application approved this calendar year. That's their goal. And then it's going to, you know, I'm sure, lead to additional applications just like the non-structural applications did. Next slide, please. All right. These are some of the, so I've showed you, so you got text. So now you see some of the pictures of some of these different parts that I've been speaking of. You see the repair sites, and you see them, you know, after, before and after cold spray. Next slide, please. Okay, and if I'm going over, I mean, somebody can just tell me to shut up because I don't think I have a whole hell of a lot left. So, again, these are some of the applications I've already alluded to. And so I'm not going to go through each one because folks from the Air Force are going to be talking about these. I've already talked about the Army ones. And I will mention, I don't know if Fred's going to mention it in his. He probably will. Early on, we worked hand in glove with the Defense Science Technology Organization in Australia. All right, and so we basically the early recipes that were developed under the ESTCP program by ARL were implemented initially under a JSF Joint Strike Fighter program funded by the Air Force. They were implemented first by the Australians. So we developed them here under JSF, and the Australians beat us and implemented the technology first. So they've been flying on longer than we have, but that just goes to show you, you know, it's just ironic how some of these things happen. Secondly, the point that I want to make is these things have been flying for a while, all right? So... again, I'm not going to steal the thunder from some of the other application people talking about their applications because they'll tell you flight hours and stuff like that. I don't want to steal their thunder. So, next slide, please. Okay, I alluded to the OSD ManTech program, and you know, basically, I told you already that is to create a production-ready system as well as a production supply chain that will deliver goods to for in support of the DoD as well as the commercial sector. I mean, this is truly a dual-use technology. There's no doubt about that. Again, you'll see a presentation by Rob Rabe, which will discuss this a little bit more in detail. Next slide, please. That's just a little snapshot, little cartoon of what this system will look like. Again, I don't want to go into a lot of the particulars because Robbie will be mad at me, but basically it uses a gantry robot instead of a you know, articulated or a, you know, pedestal robot, which has a lot of advantages, especially if you're going to entertain the idea of additive manufacturing. You've got to have the ability to control that head and to hold tight tolerances, and that's what that system will do. Next slide, please. All right, and this may be the final one or pretty damn close to it. So I alluded to the VRC system, and that is a system originally developed by ARL and commercialized in conjunction with VRC, so South Dakota School of Mines as well. And it basically represents the only hybrid system that's commercially available, and that will be the system of choice because of its flexibility, versatility, ability to go high pressure, high temperature, and to use multiple gases. All right. So we're not confined in terms of powders, in terms of gases, in terms of manual versus automated. We'll have it all. And we've been developing applications, more recently actually for NAV-C using this system. Next slide, please. And I think that should be it. All right, yeah. So this is it. I'm not here to discuss additive manufacturing, but cold spray is not thought of in those terms, but we've been making parts for years, and they've been very specialized parts initially for weapon systems. But it's like a lot of these emerging technologies. The Department of Defense spends a lot of money, develops the expertise, capability, and then private industry will take it, to the next level. But we're working in conjunction with private industry to do that. We're developing sputter targets, which have been, done for a number of years for the electronics industry using cold spray. You see the pictures of the projectiles here, shaped charge liners, donor tubes for explosive cladding, a whole myriad of different parts. So I think that's it.
Yeah. Hey, Vic.
Very good.
That's fantastic. Thank you. We've got a few questions here. You're actually under time.
Oh, good.
Yeah, you had 55 minutes, and so we had you scheduled till 2 o'clock. So
excellent.
We have time for a couple of questions if you can field them. And the first question, does the additive manufacturing process require molds?
Okay, it depends on what you're trying to do, all right? So for those shape charge liners, we use molds, okay? So we made a die, and most recently, I along with a couple of other inventors, developed a mold release agent. So we spray on the mold release agent, we spray it on, and boom, it pops right off. Other times we're using mandrels. But, you got to spray on something, to build it up. So there does have to be some support somewhere. So hopefully that answers the question.
I think so. Next question says, Vic, who manufactures the Nano 5083 powder you tested?
Okay. So there's a couple of answers to that, and actually I just held a program review right before Christmas. There's two places, and I don't even know, maybe Dr. George Kim is on the line right now, I don't know. So Dr. George Kim from Perpetual Technologies, he was he still is funded by ONR, the Office of Naval Research. I've worked in conjunction with George for a number of years, and his powder is a nano-structured powder, all right? As opposed to another company, which is called Eltron, all right? And they're located, I think, in Colorado. They have a true, and I don't want to use the word true, they're using nanoparticulates to make a cold sprayable powder. It was an idea I had about 5 years ago, and they realized that idea. So there's two companies, Eltron and Perpetual Technologies.
Okay, thanks, Vic. Next question, Vic, why do particles need to be heated to such high temperatures prior to deposition?
Yeah, okay, so you don't necessarily have to use those temperatures. Sometimes we're spraying at room temperature, all right? It depends on what the material that you're trying to spray is. If it's tantalum, which has a melting point of over, 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit, yeah, I want to heat tantalum up. If it's tin, which melts at, several hundred degrees Fahrenheit, I'm not going to heat it up to 1,000 degrees Celsius, that's for sure, because I'll just have some soup in my nozzle. So it depends on what the material is. You want to get a combination of a suitable, what we call a critical impact velocity. That critical impact velocity basically is influenced by the material, its ductility, its melting temperature, and its ability to deform. You know, different materials have different critical impact velocities, and sometimes we use a heated gas, and other times we really don't have to.
Okay. Is that really primarily then for maybe ductility then, part of that equation?
Part of the equation is ductility. So the heated gas provides some level of ductility, but more importantly, the heated gas basically, higher acceleration, you know.
Oh, okay. Oh. All right. You have more questions here, Vic.
I can talk all day.
Talking about here.
Yep.
So, let's see. The next question here is mill standard, it's 3021. It was said
right.
Both ways, and I think I can answer that one. I think I misspoke when I said 2031, and as I'm looking further, it's 3021.
Yep.
Is that correct?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, I think that's the number. I mean, that's commercially available. I mean, anybody in the world can access that spec.
Okay. So yeah, so your briefing said 3021, Vic,
okay.
And my intro, I misspoke and said 2031. I apologize for any confusion on that.
Yep.
There's a comment here that says seems very airframe component centric in applications. What about ground gear and ships?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So, you know, again, I could be on this telecon for 3 weeks talking about the applications. We have literally dozens and dozens, probably several hundred applications we've developed. That's why I mentioned on one of my first slides, automotive, petrochemical, medical, and electronics applications. A lot of my applications right now are medical, okay? All right, so it's not – I gave the aerospace applications opened the door for the approval of the first qualified cold spray, procedures. So you have to start somewhere, and aerospace was a logical choice. But automotive, okay, so automotive, you know, if you go way back, actually to NCMS, there was a program in the early 2000s I was involved with Boeing, Steve Gatos, Delphi, selective galvanizing of vehicles was one thing. I'm working on the development of chrome replacement right now. All right, so I'm doing a lot of vehicles, splines and gears sun gears for the M1 tank, for instance, and putting on chrome instead of using hexavalent chrome plating processes. More recently, we're working on, so this will be electronic/automotive, okay? So this is another automotive, but it's for hybrid vehicles. So it's for electric vehicles, in which we're using copper to deposit on a dielectric so it can be used for a motherboard in a, an electric vehicle.
Okay. And you had mentioned earlier, Vic, that you were doing some work for NAVC.
Yep.
As well.
Yep.
So,
I think Tim Eden is going to be talking today, and he'll bring up that particular application that we're working on right now, and we're also trying to develop an application for periscopes for NAVC as well.
Okay. Next question: can this process be used to repair general corrosion on A36 steel?
Yeah. All right. So A36 steel. What's hard? I mean, I don't know the relative hardness of that. So A36. All right. So basically, the harder the material. So if you have a hardness of say HRC 50 or 60, that's going to be very difficult probably to get the adhesion that you probably require for a corrosion resistant coating. Anything like 45 Rockwell or 40 Rockwell and below, yeah, you'll get decent adhesion. So the answer is, I wish I knew the hardness. It, you know, if you told me the hardness is 50, I'd say I wouldn't go that way.
Okay.
If you told me the hardness is in the 30s, then I'd say yeah.
So it's dependent on hardness as opposed to the basic substrate then.
Yeah, because typically you can find a suitable substrate that will not cause a galvanic situation. Like for the periscope, it's stainless steel, so we found a counterpart stainless steel that wasn't going to cause a galvanic issue. So steel. I mean, a lot of times we're using stainless steel on steel. We're doing steel castings for Rock Island Arsenal, and we're using a they're 4140, so we're using a 4140 material, so that obviously matches the substrate. So
okay. That
particular steel, I don't know if it's a chrome nickel steel or what. So I wish I knew off the top of my head. I don't.
Okay. Can the process be used inside a standard shrink wrap blast containment?
Can it be used inside a standard shrink wrap containment? All right. So
would there be any limitations to using it inside of a containment vessel?
Yeah. So again, I'm going to preface this with it depends, all right? And that probably you're thinking that's the easy way of wiggling out of this, but it's really not. So if you went to the last CSAT, you would have heard a presentation by Westinghouse. And we developed a procedure for basically coming up with a repair for the nuclear power industry. So that was an enclosed vessel, all right? But we had to make damn sure that we could not grit blast beforehand, because they don't want all of that contamination inside their nuclear power vessel, you know? And then secondly, we had to make darn sure that we had pretty good deposit efficiency, because if like a lot of thermal spray processes, your deposit efficiency may be 50, 60. You're lucky if you hit 70%, which means, 30, 40, 50% of your powder is going where? It's just going flying wherever. And if you can't afford that powder being dispersed everywhere, then the answer is no. However, if we're developing, again, it depends on what the mix of those particles. So you don't have to worry about them flying around. So it's really material dependent.
Okay, good answer. Thank you. So the next question is, how much testing has been done on fatigue properties of cold spray repaired materials, and how does it compare to the parent material?
Very good, excellent question, all right? So I've got 30 years, all right? So I'm getting old. I'm an old fart, all right? So I've got 30 years with the Army Research Laboratory, and before that I spent a year or two in private industry. And I've done a lot of work in those 30 years in coatings development. And for my friends at Sikorsky, I love them to death, but initially they raised the bar, all right, in terms of the testing that was required to qualify cold spray. So much so, I really got irritated with them initially. So the long-winded answer is I've never seen so many test requirements for cold spray for that magnesium repair in all my 30 years, all right? More so than with the HCAT, the high chrome action team, with the implementation of HVOF for landing gear, the tungsten carbide cobalt, above and beyond. So I've got tons and tons of fatigue data, RMR samples, also fretting fatigue data, okay, which you don't see a lot of, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So I do have tons of data, but it's very, it's specific. You know what I'm saying? So it's aluminum repair on magnesium. So we did that to death. I mean, as part of the JSF program, I think, and Fred will attest to this, we did hundreds of samples, fatigue samples for DSTO. So I've got tons and tons of data, and it's all documented in the ESTCP report. And to summarize it, it doesn't give you a debit, all right? And in some instances, for instance, if we're putting aluminum on like 7075, DSTO showed that there's actually a credit in fatigue resistance. And that's probably because the coating, you know, it becomes load bearing, all right? And so that's very much different than like a plating. A plating, it's not load bearing. So if you're applying a material that has a higher strength on a material on a substrate that has lower strength, it makes sense. And in combination with the fact that the deposit is in compression, so that I'm sure that helps. I know it helps in crack initiation, you know, which is a big part of your fatigue, your SN curve. So the answer is it doesn't give you a debit in the materials that we've investigated. We've done hundreds of samples, and in some instances, like with 7075 T6 aluminum, it actually shows a credit.
Okay. So Vic, I'm just going to pull that string a little bit more because you talked a little bit about this transition between non-structural and structural components for cold spray repairs.
Yep. Yes.
And so you know fatigue is going to be a big part of that qualification protocol for bringing those parts into operation. So is there a standard at this point, is there a more or less standard fatigue protocol for testing these kinds of, or for testing cold spray repaired components
in fatigue? Yeah, all right, so I'll answer that. So what we did is, the test matrix that was developed under the ESTCP program was modeled under the HCAT. All right, so initially we took the test protocol that was established for tungsten carbide cobalt coatings applied by HVOF, and that was our skeleton, and we worked from there. So, you know, we're using, as far as the fatigue samples, we're using dog bones that are both cylindrical and threaded, as well as flat dog bones, and we're applying, you know, the coating onto those specimens in the gauge area. So there's a very specified ASTM standard practice of doing that. In addition, you know, we developed a JTP, a joint test protocol, of our own. And we had input from Army, Navy, Air Force, and the folks from AMCOM, you know, MRDIC, the Aviation Missile Command for the Army, said, look, if you're going to develop a procedure for repairing worn, you know, sites, what we want to do is develop our own dog bone that has a simulated defect, so it's got a little divot in it, and we want you to fill that in, and we want to fatigue test that. And I said, that's a good idea, too. So that's an additional fatigue test that's not really an ASTM standard per se, although we are using, you know, a dog bone that conforms to that, but we're using a specified geometry, so we scallop out a divot in the gauge area, we fill it up with corrosion, and what they want to know, they want to just make sure that there's no debit. They're not interested in getting the credit, they just want to make sure there's no debit. So we did those tests too, and they came out fine. Okay. And we did fretting fatigue. So fretting fatigue, again, you know, that's basically, you know, just a quick summary. I mean, it's a fatigue test, but you have a pin, all right, that is under pressure that contacts a point in the middle of the gauge area, so you get this fretting action. You know, so you get a pin is under a prescribed pressure that these structures guys figure out, and it frets. You know, and the thing's in fatigue at the same time. So that has already been done. So this data. And that's what I mean by I was irritated by Sikorsky initially, because they gave me requirements for a structural repair, even though we were trying to implement a non-structural repair. So, if it's non-structural, what the hell are we doing fretting fatigue and impact resistance, But I'm glad we did because we've laid the groundwork. I mean, we've already satisfied, 90% of what we need for structural repair, and that's why it's only going to take till the end of this year to implement that, because at this point in time, all we have to do is component testing. You know, you can't get away, well, at least in the applications we're looking at, we can't get away from component testing. So that's basically the final test that we've got to do.
Okay, so it sounds to me like, if we were going to put together a joint, under CSAT, a joint test protocol, then we could leverage all this work that's been done already on this ESTCP report as a great starting point for that.
Oh, absolutely. But again, everything is materials dependent. So
understood.
We looked at, aluminum on magnesium. Now, if somebody wants to take a look at a different combination, well, we can use the joint test protocol that we established. We don't have to start from square one, but, obviously, we'll have to generate data.
But that's, in my view, from a holistic transition perspective, that's a great start, is that we're not all inventing our own test, our own qualification matrices and test protocols. We have something to start from, and then we start building the body of knowledge and the data sets that support that then for the enterprise.
You're absolutely correct, and I will tell you that joint test protocol that was established was basically input from 150 individuals representing industry, government, and academia.
Okay. Let's move on to the next question. For use on steel, what is the minimum maximum deposition rates?
All right. For use on steel, so what are we putting on steel? Zinc? Are we putting aluminum? Are we putting... So I'm going to give you a general answer that, again, I don't want to say it's meaningless, but it's going to be specific to a system, all right? We can lay down about 30 pounds of aluminum on steel per hour.
Okay.
That gives you a ballpark.
Let's go to the next question. What was the aluminum powder you used to gain 7% elongation deposited with a low-pressure or high-pressure system?
Go ahead.
And we'll start with that part one of the question.
All right. Yeah, I'm laughing because, somebody's out there taking some good notes. They want the magic recipe. That's a process that's developed under the OSD Mantec program in conjunction with Moog. So it's going to be a Moog, process. But I will tell you, there's going to be a powder spec out on it this year, so everybody and their brother will be able to buy the powder, but it's basically the processing of the powder that, that's not going to be contained in that spec, but you'll be able to buy the powder. We presented that at the CSAT this past summer. That powder is from Valamet, okay? You can speak to them, and they can give you the same batch that we did all of our work on. But it's the processing of the powder that makes the difference, and it's the process parameters. Now, as far as low pressure or high pressure, you're going to need a high pressure system. So if you've got a low pressure system, you're not going to be able to produce those strengths.
Okay, good answer. Thank you. Next question says, is there any data from DOD weld engineers available?
DOD from weld engineers. So I'm wondering specifically what they're looking for. I don't understand the question from weld engineers. I've got tons of data representing all sorts of mechanical, chemical, and physical tests. I don't know what they, if they said, do you have a bend test? that you would use in terms of testing the ductility like you do in a weld. I don't know what they mean by a weld engineer, you know, a test from a weld. Do you, Greg? I don't know what that means.
Well, I it's not my question, but I suspect it's, well, we had a recent discussion on additive manufacturing during that forum, and it seems to me that the additive manufacturing community at large relies heavily on weld specifications and weld parameters to develop the test, you know, the qualification and test protocols for qualifying additive manufactured things.
Yeah.
I imagine it's along the same lines as those questions. Do we leverage, you know, the American Welding Institute and other things when we're putting together these qualification and test protocols?
All right, so the answer is yes. And we actually go well beyond AWS specification in terms of, I mean, we've got impact tests, we've got bend tests, we've got fretting fatigue. You don't do fretting fatigue in AWS. A whole plethora of probably the chemistry composition, all that is the same as what is in AWS. I'm doing a program right now testing the integrity of cold spray deposits welded either to each other or to conventional rock material. And, there's nothing that, maybe I'll say it this way. The JTP would be all-inclusive, so it would include those tests that you would find in an AWS specification, you know. I may be wrong on that, but I don't think so. With the plethora of tests, I don't think... Because we even, you know, we bend coupons around a mandrel. I mean, that's the only one that I would say would be really specific to like a weld. All the other ones, the tension, the impact, they're all inclusive. So, yeah,
okay.
I mean, people should do is get access to that ESTCP report. It's a 167-page report, all filled with data. And if there's something additional that we didn't do,
what we'll do, Vic, on that front is we'll be glad to post that ESTCP report, given again proper permissions, on the JTAG website. And there's a link already from the JTAG website to the CSAT website and back and forth.
Right.
So if you can get to one place, you can get to the other place, and that report
right.
should be readily available, again, based on proper permissions from ESTCP CERTIF on that.
Yeah, see, that's the thing, and I forget how they registered it. I don't know if it's government and government contractors. I know there's a
right.
distribution, but it's not for just government only. I know that.
Right, so we've got that for action. We'll look into that, and I have a feeling it's open kimono, and it should soon be posted.
Yeah.
Next
got
question.
It. Yeah.
What is the lower limit for standoff distance and impingement angle? For example, I'm having a hard time reading the questions because it's a tough format here.
Right.
What is the lower limit for standoff distance and impingement angle? For example, what interior? Oh shoot!
I can answer it based upon what you just said. You know.
Uh huh.
All right. So you get a two-folded question. So, what's the minimum standoff distance? Okay. You know, our typical standoff distances are, I don't know, like 3/8, maybe a half inch to maybe an inch or so. That's typical. I usually don't try to go right up to the surface. So, you know, can I put the nozzle right up to the surface and get something? I don't know. But, I mean... typically, a good 3/8, half an inch. I mean, that's your typical. If you want to push the limit and go closer, Yeah, but you just gotta watch out in terms of if you're doing a complex geometry and what have you, and you're using an automated or is it handheld system. So that's number one. And number two, what was the second part?
Impingement angle.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a great question. So we've done studies on impingement angle, and with some materials, I mean, everybody has been under the impression for years and years and years, you've got to be normal to the surface. So the nozzle's got to be 90 degrees, perpendicular to the surface. That's not true. That's just not true. We get sometimes better adhesion going at an angle. So people didn't realize that. But again, it's materials and substrate dependent, so you can't make a general overall statement, because what holds true for some materials won't hold true for other materials. You get what I'm saying? So
I do.
I guess the answer, the only way I can answer that in general terms without being specific to a coating substrate system is basically say, you got to look at it. But we have results which have shown that angles, 80 degrees, 70 degrees, even 45 degrees gives us better adhesion than going 90 degrees.
Got it. And I'm going to give a shout out to Heather Taylor here. Heather has lots and lots of questions regarding cold spray applications on steel. And Heather, I would encourage you to get with Vic directly, as offline, as part of the networking that's supposed to take place. Post a forum like this to get some of your questions answered. We've got lots and lots and lots of questions here to go through from other folks. So we've answered a bunch of those questions, and I would just ask you to get with Vic offline if we haven't answered all of your questions at this point. Next question says, are there residual stresses on the substrate due to cold spray?
Yeah, yep.
Probably
exactly.
More of a fatigue type question, right?
Yeah, and these are great questions. These are excellent. I love this. So, again, it's going to be dependent on material and substrate, as you well could imagine, because, think about what's happening. You're taking these particulates. These are like round, like round pieces of clay, and you're slamming them against a hard surface. Okay, so the harder the substrate, the less deformation of that substrate as a result of the particle impact. But in the case of like aluminum and magnesium, they're kind of neck and neck with one another in terms of ductility and stiffness. Magnesium a little bit stiffer, but they're neck and neck in terms of kind of hardness and strength, so they really go well together. So there's some extreme impact and mechanical mixing at the substrate, all right? I showed an example of that in one of my slides. So with that, you will develop some compressive stresses into the substrate. So we've done residual stress analysis through various coatings, copper coatings, aluminum coatings, I think even some tantalum coatings on steel, aluminum on magnesium, aluminum on aluminum, copper on, aluminum as well. And bottom line is throughout the entire cold spray deposit, all right, and the deposits ranged anywhere from like 5 mils to maybe 25 mils. There were compressive stresses throughout the entire deposit. And even into the substrate, like 3, 4, 5 mils. The magnitude of those compressive stresses vary with whatever the material you're spraying.
Okay. Next question: how loud, by decibels, is the process application?
Yeah, I should know that off the top of my head. I'm embarrassed that I don't know. We do it in acoustical room. All right. If we're doing it outside, in an aircraft hangar or out in the field somewhere, we're here. We are wearing hearing protection. All right. you know, so we're following OSHA requirements. And if I looked in, we have an SOP, a standard operating procedure that is, you know, dozens of pages long. It has that information in there. But you got to wear hearing protection, all right? You wear hearing protection, you're fine. You don't operate the system's too loud to operate without hearing protection. But simple hearing protection, you know, is all you need. You don't need anything that is special beyond, you know, the little things, little conformable, you know, flexible foamy things you put in your ears, and maybe in conjunction with, you know, the earmuff type of hearing protection. So. You don't need an you don't need an astronaut suit.
Okay. Here's a good question that kind of has a global kind of connotation here. It says, what entities will have the most impact in producing a cold spray specification? The OEM, the owner, DOD/commercial aircraft operators, FAA repair shops, third parties. Where should we focus in producing specs?
All right. Well, that's a great question. I can tell you, again, I take the universal approach. All right. So, whenever I develop a joint test protocol or I develop a specification, it's with input from all of the above. So that MIL standard 3021, again, was input from all of the above, from, you know, heavily by industry, which included folks that were FAA, like Moog, FAA certified people that were users. It included equipment producers, you know, like from Centerline and ASB and, you know, folks like that. It included, you know, the Aviation Missile Command from the Army. It included people from NAVAIR. It included, like a person who's going to speak, Dr. Tim Eden from Penn State, academia. It included all of the above. And I do that purposely so I don't get my fanny kicked later on saying, hey, how come you didn't ask this sector or that sector? Now, in regards to, so it's good to have these general specifications like for powder and for the cold spray process. But when it comes down to the development of specific applications, all right, that's going to probably be spearheaded by the industry leaders in that particular entity. For instance, you know, this application we've developed for the automotive industry. ARL didn't dictate what the qualification requirements were. All right. They said this is what we need for thermal conductivity. This is what we need for weldability. And that's a thing I didn't even talk about. Like weldability and thermal shock was a requirement for this hybrid electric vehicle application. And then they asked, you know, about our joint test protocol. They said, is there anything else from a materials, from a cold spray perspective that you think we should add in addition to, you know, our specific applications requirements? And, you know, we did talk about, yes, you got to, you know, in terms of chemical composition of your powders, it's very important. You want to keep down your oxides in the powder. You have too much oxide in the powder, you won't reach your electrical conductivity. It won't be a fault of the cold spray. It will be a fault of the feedstock powder you're using. So, kind of long-winded answer, but I think it has to be it's kind of a symbiotic relationship from the people who are developing applications, people who are making the powders, people who are using the system, and the people who basically have the applications that they want developed.
Okay. One of our guests has taken the initiative to go up and look up the Rockwell hardness of 836 steel and come to find out that it's greater than 60.
Yeah, forget it. Yeah.
Forget it. Right.
Yeah, I wouldn't even attempt it. Now people are going to say, gee, I thought you could use cold spray on ceramics. You show some pictures of cold spray on ceramics. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But I will tell you, like, you know, we developed a process to basically metallize ceramic materials. and that was to do away with the copper the electroplate the ceramics with copper. It's a subtractive process, and then they have to etch it all away, and they just want a few traces. We use cold spray to develop these specific electronic traces on ceramics. But the requirement was they only needed like a few hundred PSI adhesion. So that's what you're going to get, all right? You're going to get anywhere probably from maybe 500. If you're lucky, maybe a couple thousand, maybe a couple thousand PSI. If you can live with that adhesion, then that's fine. But we're looking at adhesions typically for the applications that we're developing much greater than, you know, like 10,000 PSI. So when you talk to somebody and you say, well, you're only going to get, you know, 700, 800 or maybe 1,000 PSI, they'll say, forget it.
Okay. So in the interest of time here, and this is fantastic, these questions are great. Your answers are superb. This is exactly the kind of interchange we're trying to facilitate through this forum. I'm going to take one more question, and then what we're going to do is for the remaining questions, we'll send those to you, Vic, and
sure.
We will provide each one of those folks that asked the question an answer directly, okay?
Yeah.
So the last question here, it seems that this process product could be useful in the production prophylaxis as well as in repair. Has there been any OEMs willing to apply these coatings in the production process, perhaps as part of a reliability improvement program?
Okay, so the answer is yes. Boeing has already done it. All right, and so I developed a procedure with Boeing here at Mid-America, and Mid-America has pumped out a couple of production parts. And Sikorsky has done the same thing. All right. Now, the specific applications, you know, I can't get into, you know, the specific parts and whatever, you know, without their permission. But in general terms, you know, you're repairing castings. So, you know, these big expensive castings come out of the production line, and they've got either a shrinkage cavity or some sort of surface defect in which basically deems them rejectable. So in years past, they would try to do like a weld repair, but when you're talking some of these materials, you can't do a weld repair. You just get too much distortion to the substrate, and then the part's no good anyway. So they actually perform cold spray, and these parts are going in inventory, and they'll be on aircraft.
Okay, and with that, we're gonna move on to our next speaker. And again, I want to thank you, Vic, for taking your time today to present where ARL and where CSAT are going with cold spray, what we're doing, and then answering these questions with such great detail. So again, thanks for that.
Okay, you're welcome. I appreciate the opportunity.
Did you want to introduce your speaker?
Sure. Yeah, I see. I see the next speaker here, and you know, these are folks that that I've worked with throughout the years.
Yeah.
Who have been on the leading edge of cold spray. We've been kind of in the trenches together. The next speaker is Dr. Tim Eden. He's from Penn State University. Am I getting it right, Greg? Because I see Fred and Tim, and so I don't know if Fred's on first and then Tim, or maybe it might be Fred. I think Fred.
I think we've got Fred up first and then Tim.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So
that's mine.
So forget what I said about Tim. We'll talk about Fred now. So Fred was. Hey, Fred's been in the trenches since the early days, since we started the ESTCP, the DSTO work, and we've worked together in various capacities. You know, Fred's up the food chain, so he's a good guy to know because he can make things happen. And he was very instrumental in forming some of the larger cold spray programs for the Navy, in which we were delighted to be able to collaborate with him on, and to see some of the applications development through. And Fred is from NAVAIR, and with that, I'll introduce him.
Okay. All right. Hey, Vic, thanks for the introduction. As Vic said, I'm the Fred Lancaster at NAVAIR, stationed here at Pax River. I am the 4th Air Force Reform Materials Division Science and Technology Lead. In the former life, I was in the corrosion and wear branch. So we did started a lot of this work. I have to say it's been a lot of people to make things happen. We've taken a pretty joint approach. About a little before 2006, Yogi Kessler, our FRC S&T lead, he was looking at cold spray for the FRCs. In fact, had already purchased a lot of equipment based upon an opportunity that he was able to get a lot of hardware for Cherry Point, because a lot of his work is centered around a lot of helicopter work, as you can see. But so he really pioneered and started on it, and so I'm up here at headquarters and able to kind of help facilitate and a three-ring circus, basically. So I'll show you as we go. We've got a pretty good NAVAIR team from all of our materials divisions in power and propulsion across the country throughout all of our depots. So go ahead to the next slide. So one thing about cold spray is that it really fit within to the big Navy S&T focus. It's affordable, maintainability, reliability, and specifically S&T objectives is platform affordability and availability. It's something we've never had before, which was to easily repair aluminum substrates, in service, or just in the depot. We're in a horrible salt environment, we make our aircraft out of materials that like get eaten away in salt. So it's really, really a big paradigm shift. It's always been, we've relied on logistics to deliver parts, where now we can actually repair parts and put them back in service. So, in these more austere times, it's been a big, big cost savings. And so we can go ahead and go to the next slide. So this is kind of a snapshot of just some of the past projects we worked on, and these are focused on specific platforms. We're looking at repair of, as a coatings repair. Just for cadmium and aluminum coatings, it's a great technology. It's a green technology in that respect. We're looking at as alternatives for cadmium plating, but basically for as a repair process for those alternatives for things like cad plating, which IBD aluminum is. We've had that in use for years, but we've never had a good repair process. That's where we're looking at cold spray as a aluminum method as fulfilling that repair process. It's typically something like that, if it gets damaged in service in the depot, usually during handling, is we run it back through the system. So that's a lot of money. We're looking at copper coatings on ring gears. Vic did a lot of work on that. That's still something that it's a big area, because if we can we deposit copper down on steel, and this is basically for a run
on the right hand side like that.
It's a thermal type coating, so it dissipates the heat. But the problem is with copper is we plate, and then we have to HE bake in between cycles. So it's a long process. Cold spray is a very quick process for depositing copper, and we don't have to worry about doing hydrogen brilliant bakeout. Something I'll show on here is F-18 AMAT gearbox repair. We also did work with on a TIPS program for UH-1, combining gearbox, and concurrently getting Penn State under RepTech program, having them work with us on various repairs for the F-18. Okay, you can go ahead and flip to the next slide. So this is kind of busy, but it shows that from FY05 all the way through to the present, we've done a lot of work. We've increased our not only our hardware, but also we through Section 219, which is a research and development funding source that we have specifically for the workforce development portion of 219, we were able to get our workforce trained up at all of our depots and here at Pax River, get our scientists trained up, get our artisans and our engineers at the depot trained. So that actually helped the human factor of just getting trained in cold spray. And, a lot of that was we'd go, Vic had the lab at ARL, We were able to send people there. He had regular forums, having regular forums there. We had CSAT. All that plays into getting the human, our human assets up and educated in this technology. So as you can see, I got that big green arrow going through in the middle there. So we have the Army collaboration with DEMVAL testing, information exchange, project teaming, and overall, providing, working with a DoD vision. So all of that kind of just runs right through it. So you can see that in the end, coming up to right now, we've got a good framework of throughout the NAV air of to be able to support cold spray and to be able to support repairing our products. Okay, go to the next. So one of the things I'm showing this slide is this is a portable system, field deployable robotic system that the Australian DSTO came up with. It's something we worked on with the Army, Sikorsky, and Penn State, looking at looking into field deployable robotic systems. So we really see this as something that we need in a depot because what ends up happening is we're tearing apart an aircraft, and all of a sudden, we see corrosion. I mean, heavy pitting corrosion. And what we do right now is, if there's a piece of the frame, you have to remove that section of frame. That's a lot of man hours. And then, like we're doing on like B-22, we have an issue where we actually take a long, big chunk of aluminum, and we machine out that frame, piece of frame, and we put it back on the aircraft. So where if we have a system that can come up to an aircraft, robotically, encapsulate the aircraft and be able to do the repair, that'll save us a lot of money. So kind of showing that, this is something where we see interest, something that seeing where the technology is going. Vic is working on that. But it's something really, really in the future. A robot will help to be precise, and we can see where this will go right into the. You can pull it up next to an aircraft, right in the depot. So you're allowing for a quick repair, and we're not impeding that aircraft to getting out. So next slide. So really showing the effect of, how far does cold spray permeate throughout nav air? Well, it goes all the way through. Not quite yet the polymers and composites branch yet, but I can see that one of these days there'll be applications in there. that they'll come aboard. But we have NDI, we have industrial operation chemicals, metal, ceramics, corrosion wear, of course, analytical chemistry and testing branch. But not only here at PAX, but over all the United States, at Cherry Point, Jacksonville, North Island, and I can see on the next slide the capability at those facilities since 2006, actually probably within the past, since 2009, we've got a lot of these capabilities is FRCE. They have the most capabilities for production. We have high and low pressure. PAX River, we have a low pressure for portable, so we can do R&D testing. So does Jacksonville, North Island. But also we're working with NAVC. Carter Rock has had a system since 2004. Keyport has a system. And then also Naval Postgraduate School has a low pressure cabinet system. Next slide. So really, this is to show, you know, we developed the internal, you know, who are internal and external stakeholders that we deal with and partner with and work with on a regular basis. We have a lot of direct, you know, collaboration with internally, you know, throughout our propulsion and power structures, non-destructive tests. You know, that's, of course, the big thing. We make repairs. We have to be able to see if we actually have a good repair. Doing a lot of work with them. Penn State, of course, our PMAs, which are our aircraft programs. 265 is F-18. 299 is H-60. And mostly a lot with those because they are the aircraft that we use a lot. Working with our fleet readiness centers, with our aircraft suppliers, with outside, with our international partners, and with Carter Rock and with Naval Postgrad. But also, you know, in partnerships, I'd say are more, you know, we form strong partnerships, and we see with Army Research Lab, we have Naval Postgrad School at Monterey. So basically, all of these, we're trying to go from a R&D, a very low TRO level all the way through to transition. I guess you can look at that way. And that kind of shows, you know, some of the projects that we have. I've pointed out here at the bottom, you know, where we receive money from. Things like TIPS, ONR TIPS, DLA, FBIRs, AirMIP is an internal NAVAIR program for transition. REPTEC, MANTEC, ONR SBAs. So it just shows you that we're looking at this from various TRL levels. You know, each of the issues we have that relate to an aircraft, you know, it traces itself back to each problem is at a different degree, is at a different level of S&T. Some of you will see later on they're at a further level, TRL level, make it easier for transition. But it kind of shows you that, you know, we have to work with various levels of funding and various levels of where the problem lies in the technology level state that it's in. Okay, next slide. And for some of the people probably asking, okay, what do we work on? This is a pretty comprehensive list of the alloys that we have on aircraft now, mainly aluminum. Aluminum for a lot of our skins, our structures. Steel alloys, that mainly we're looking at landing gear, a lot of high-strength steel for that. Magnesium alloys, we're trying to phase those out, but we're going to have those in the fleet for a long time. But those are mainly gearboxes. And then, of course, titanium. Okay, next slide. So Dr. Wolk and I, we sat down one day and put together an S&T analysis of basically things of interest to the Navy and NAVAIR. I'm not going to read through this, but it basically what we're looking at through this is these are type of things you know, the statement says is we need to tie fundamental understanding of the process parameters and the operating envelope to the coating properties. And not necessarily meaning coating, meaning, you know, putting a thin layer for galvanic, but for your buildup, for what end results do you have. So these are the type of things that we need to look at when you're creating a process. Next slide. And in some, this is kind of like a rough like hierarchy of where we see we're going. We're going from, we've looked at the lower level, which is the low-hanging fruit, the easy stuff. Not necessarily easy, but it's a lot less costly, a lot less intensive. We're not involving structures into it. So as we start getting up to structures, structural development, that's where, you know, we're getting to a lot more cost, a lot more risk. But yet we're also building up our capabilities. So we're also expanding out, you know, what we can do and the type of repairs that we're able to facilitate. So, and at top, we can see some of the things that Vic's ARL is already doing, Vic and his group, is they're also looking at advanced power development. So it's kind of like right now, we're being very simplistic. We're looking at single alloys that we know, but, you know, Vic's working like with nano powders and such. That's where we really want to see that. Some of the uniqueness of this technology is we like to see what can you do when you combine different things, different materials, and what can you get out of it. So it really makes it novel. It's just not single metal repair. You know, it's something we can mix powders, and we come out and instead of before with traditional melting of your materials together, you know, we can see what we can get with new material properties and therefore new applications. So really, you know, NAVAIR, we've been concentrating on basically fixing a lot of stuff that's corroded. Since it is something that fits within fits very well within our mission. Basically within what kind of aircraft, what kind of equipment, and what kind of substrates we have to be able to fix. Okay, next slide. So that kind of segues into what our approach has been. You know, our approach has been, you know, since about 2006 is looking at it that, hey, this is something that is ready for prime time, and, you know, this is going to be a big help to us in the fleet. And that's basically what we've been doing. And this is that kind of process. Is we develop, we qualify, we check, we assure. Okay, next slide. So what have we done? As of, you know, FY12, I can say we've got our workforce and we've got our depots up and operational. We've got a trained workforce. It's no longer any type of black magic. It's been very well received and being utilized. We've got things done like development tests and operational tests for fretting corrosion repair on our AMAD gearboxes. We have parts flying in the fleet. We can call those types of applications low hanging fruit. They're now out in the fleet. We've got other parts of our gear, F-18 gearbox, the AMAD gearbox that we have built up for repair. Still in developmental test. Actually now with 13 we've got parts out in the fleet. We've upgraded our systems at FRC East with a large auxiliary heater to our CGT unit. And for 13 actually was kind of slow due to the sequestration, to be honest with you. It's really kind of hampered our ability to get out and look at, you know, go out into the go out and work with our depot engineers, see exactly what they're talking about with repairs, you know, to meet and be able to help facilitate our counterparts out at the depots, helping them with transitioning this. So hopefully looking at 14 is going to be a lot better for this. Okay. And 14, what we're looking at, next slide. So 14, we've got a number of applications we're geared at investigating and maybe not yet transitioning, but I'd have to say with S18, we want to look at, we have some corroded radar racks. You can see those. We don't have to take them off the aircraft. They're, we're saving a significant amount of money. So you're looking at peanuts. So with this technology, you're also looking at the basic peanuts you're throwing at it for a project, for the repair, for the equity you're getting out in repairs and what you're returning to the fleet. Looking at getting an IBD repair qualified. H60, we've got various canted bulkhead repair. That's basic bushing repair. So that's one big area we have is aluminum. Anytime it gets corrodes around fasteners, we end up drilling a hole out bigger and putting in a bushing. So we think with this technology, we should be able to get away from using bushings, which would be outstanding. Looking at gearbox repair, V22, we've got a window sill issue. That's kind of a short-term, fixing things short-term as the depot implements a long-term solution. Getting our FRCs to have independent teams that can greater facilitate, repairs there. And so the big thing is also looking at a portable repair process, and then also to, keep further up our collaboration between, the Navy, our internal collaboration, with the Marine Corps, with Carter Rock, with NAVC. So, summary, next slide, is our focus here has been, really, really to work with the maintainers and work with trying to keep our assets flying, trying to lower costs, out in the fleet. But also concurrently, it's been a lot of work with the human resources and also our physical capabilities. So we can have all the equipment we want, but we don't have the human resources able to do it, and we don't have the subject matter experts groomed up. We don't have the scientists who are able to provide good science and technology that can validate the processes, and then also have depot engineers who are able to spot those areas and come up with procedures that are practical and affordable for repairing aircraft. Then no matter how good the equipment is, it doesn't really matter. So that's been a big focus of our efforts. Now, I also have, I threw in the back a gava slide, which I'd like to go through quickly on just platform-specific repairs. So if you can flip to the next slide. And Greg, you can cut me off.
Hey, Fred.
Yeah.
Greg here. You're going to have to really whip through these things quickly. There's a lot of slides in here, so
yeah.
I would encourage you to just maybe hit the ones that are unique and
yeah,
then move on to
kind of
hit some
of
RC, if you will.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead and flip to the next one. Okay, we've seen that one. Vic's really showed that in his. Flip that one. Okay, here's the sump that Vic talked about. Sikorsky is actually taking their current flame spray process, and what they've done is qualified cold spray aluminum as an alternative. So it's a lot better process because it's we can do more repetitive repairs with it because we don't get the heat affected zone. Okay, go ahead next. This is a good thing. This shows you how our gearboxes come back from the fleet. Very corroded. I mean, this is just the top. The top looks, it'll get out and get repaired. But really, we're looking at some of the things is using the aluminum as a sacrificial layer, which would give us a lot more time on wings. Okay, go ahead. Next one. This one, you can see we're on the lower right-hand picture shows you little things where we get nicks and dings and such just from maybe removing, you know, doing maintenance, and how that ends up becoming a defect that, even though how small it is, it, you may have to pull that gearbox off. Okay, next. And 860 main gearbox. Thing here to take away here, as you can see, basically with all of our gearboxes, is where they mount to the frame is where we get a lot of corrosion. We've done a lot of work. The Australians have been flying aircraft around for coming up on 5 years. So, you know, gearboxes, big thing, made of magnesium. They like to corrode. Okay, next. We got FRC East. Next. Quickly, these are some of the repairs that Sikorsky has approved cold spray as an alternative. Next. And next. So we got gearboxes, tail gearbox output housing. Next. There you can see our mounting feet. You can see how the pictures don't really do it justice. For 53, they're pretty big pieces of hardware. Next. But at least you can see, you know, where we're actually spraying, you know, what kind of space restrictions we have. Next. This is actually a copy, so go to the next one. Things like this pop up, little servo cylinders. You can see just some place where it was drilled, pinhole, never drilled through. So we can actually repair things where we press in, you know, bushings and such. Next. This is another housing. Okay. Next. You can see we're doing a lot of flanges, flat surfaces, mating surfaces. Next. This is a TIPS, an ONR TIPS project that was the Cherry Point headed up, Yogi and his crew down there. And this is, let's see, go to the next slide. Next slide, go to the one next, you'll see that one with a, there we go, this one. So, yeah, that's good. This is actually chafing from a composite fairing that on our H1 upgrade. So, again, another non-predicted defect non-predicted repair coming up from an improved aircraft from the fleet. You know, we get that all the time. Even when we build aircraft, we expect that, you know, when it gets out there in the fleet, there's going to be certain things, mostly corrosion, that we're going to encounter that we have to fix. Okay, next. So it wears across in a straight line, but this kind of shows you where you can actually spray it down, spray your cold spray down, build it up, and you can grind it back while it's on the aircraft. Okay, next. Okay, so FRC Southwest and Southeast. Next. This is where we're talking about the AMAD gearbox. We have one on each engine. You can see where it goes in relation to the aircraft. Next. We've got two types of damage. This is a fretting corrosion. So we've actually repaired more than six of these. We've got about seven 780s repaired and are going back in fleet. So this is now a local process specification that they can repair these out at North Island. Next. Now this one's a little bit more complicated, same gearbox, but it's on the internal. A lot of internal damage we work with Penn State on. We removed a lot of material due to damage, and we replaced all that material back and to its original mechanical or better properties. Next. Some IBD aluminum repair down at Jacksonville. So instead of running this thing all the way back through this bomb rack, all the way back through, they were able to do a local repair. Okay, next. So, and this is, it's been out, they've had it out, assembled, they're monitoring this bomb rack for corrosion, and it's still going great. So it's all the stuff that we learned from early on, working with ARL and doing a gaggle of corrosion tests, has been validated. Okay, next. And should go next to be a spotting dolly axle pin. Significant as this is, it's nickel cobalt phosphorus plated. That's one of the candidate platings we're looking at as alternatives. But we're testing it out on ground support equipment. That's one thing we try to do here is we try to test things out on things that don't fly. So these are our partners up at Lakehurst. These things are repaired down at Jacksonville. Go to next. And this is repaired with a manual process, with a manual gun. So we're monitoring that. Next, so that worked out well. That's being implemented. Basically that's it for the end of the presentation. So that's kind of a real quick snapshot of things, what we're doing.
Hey, Fred, that's fantastic. Thank you for that. And I agree. It was, I guess, of a lot of value to go through then, those slides at the end there. Even if we did it quickly to show what kind of things NAVAIR has been working on across COM-FRC to repair those components. And I would encourage anybody, if they have any specific questions on those repairs, to get with Fred directly post today's telecon.
Yeah, so go ahead. I'll gladly get you in contact with those people, the FRCs, if it's that specific, or whatever I'll answer from here.
Very good. And
All right.
And also I'll let you know that part of this, of the overall Cold Spray Technology Forum's PDF that's here, all of these presentations are resident in that particular file. So Fred's presentation, as well as Vic's presentation, as well as Rob's forthcoming presentation, are available in that particular file there. So we've got some questions for you, Fred. And it says, first question is, what is the base material of the rain gear that was copper-coated?
Let's see.
Remember?
No, I don't remember on that one.
Okay, so maybe what we can do is we'll forward you these questions.
Just go ahead and forward them.
If you can help us with some answers, that would be great.
I don't know. It could have been a 300M or AirMint 100.
Okay. And then there's another question here that says, who is the point of contact at the Naval Surface Warfare Center?
Carter Rock?
Doesn't specify.
Oh, that's Dr. Jen Wolk, who's sitting here right next to me.
Okay.
And also we've been working with Ben Buffard, too, so either or.
And if Carter Rock is in the right warfare center and you're asking about Keyport, I would refer them back to Brian Mahoney over at Keyport.
Okay. And then there's a question here that says, did you spray 300M powder onto 300M substrate? What adhesion strength were you able to attain?
Yeah, that's easy to answer. No. No, and no, we haven't sprayed 300M powder. We've primarily sprayed just aluminum powders. I'm just showing 300M was on there as an example of, now we sprayed aluminum onto 300M for IVD repair.
Okay. Here's a question that says, what kind of collaborative efforts does NAVAIR have with NAVC in Cold Spray?
Right now, we've had a technical exchange of personnel. Dr. Wolk has been resident here for almost 2 years. And we now have she'll be going back, and we'll be having an engineer from here going up to Carter Rock as an exchange. So we're kind of doing this. We're doing a personnel exchange in education.
Okay.
Hey, this is Daynard. Am I allowed to speak?
Yes.
Okay, just real quick, as some may know, in addition to that personnel exchange, we at NAVC, with some of our projects, an FBIR project, it's run by Brian Mahoney at Keyport, who Jen mentioned, an FBIR project, and also a RepTech project with Penn State ARL, Dr. Tim Eden and company, who will be talking. We put together a monthly teleconference meeting to kind of collaborate between those two projects and make sure that those two projects were aligned and mutually beneficial. And as part of that teleconference, Jen participates regularly. In fact, gave a briefing similar to what was just given to our NAVC group. Yogi Kessler from FRC East participates regularly. So in addition to that personnel exchange, we're also very much engaging, in that venue, literally and figuratively, through a monthly or so teleconference where we're managing these projects and the relationships that are formed with those folks. So we're learning a great deal from Jen and all the folks at NAV Air, Yogi, and very much are in the spirit and context of JTAG, we are closely working. Over.
Okay. Next question for you, Fred.
Okay.
What do you do to clean and prep a corroded airframe area for cold spray repair, and to what extent does the surface need to be cleaned prior to cold spray?
Well, for the repairs that we've done, like with V-22 windowsill, we have pitting corrosion. We've ground out those areas we go to a certain depth and width ratio. That's typically what we do. We remove the corrosion, get it smooth. So, we're having deep valleys to spray into. We'll clean it, with a solvent cleaner, just to wipe it down, really not necessary after grinding. We may hit it lightly with some aluminum oxide abrasive. Then we go ahead and fill it back up with material.
Okay. Next question. Is there a query for Vic Champagne? This is a query for Vic Champagne. Any cold spray application on ceramic parts? So I guess really anybody can answer that question if you know.
Yeah, I mean, this is Vic Champagne. Yeah, there is. I also have an answer for the first question. That was where somebody asked the gear material, because we did the work at ARL, so I'm just looking at that up right now. I got the drawing right in front of me. It's probably a nitroloid because it's a nitrided steel. So you're in upwards of 60 Rockwell C, but on the areas that we coated on that, it was 38 to 44. And that's kind of right in the ballpark is what I said. If you're around the high 30s or 40s, you're okay. So it was like 38 to 44 Rockwell C. So it was, it's a nitrided steel. Anyway, in regards to, there's been applications developed for ceramics. I alluded to one earlier with the, we basically developed an alternative to DBC process, the direct bonded copper process, which is used extensively on ceramics to basically provide an electrical path. The DBC process is basically copper plating ceramics. So we don't have to do that. Copper plating, first of all, is very slow, tedious, and it's a subtractive process, meaning, you put a piece of ceramic in, you're forced to coat the entire thing and then etch off what you don't want. Cold spray would be an additive process where you just put on the electronic traces, the electrical traces that you want on that particular part. Yeah, you got to mask it, but basically what took probably 8 to 10 hours to do, we did in about 30 seconds. So that's one particular application. on ceramics. Metallizing ceramics, has been the kind of the holy grail for many years. So, you know, cold spray. Again, the thing you got to consider is what do you need for adhesion. So,
okay. And here's a question for you, Fred. Hopefully you know this one. What was the base material of the spotting dolly axle pin that you were able to repair?
I really don't. I can find out for you. That was something Jack still did.
Okay. That'll be fine.
Let's see. It was. Let's see. They say. No, they don't. They don't say. So I can find. Direct it to me, and I'll be able to tell you.
Okay.
It was a repair of the nickel cobalt phosphorus coating. So there had been some there, but it was lightly coated. So what we were actually doing was coating the nickel cobalt phosphorus coating, not directly onto the steel.
Okay. Another question for you, Fred, and I think you've kind of answered this before, but have you fielded any repairs that have completely restored the strength of the part?
If that's related to structural, then the answer would be no. We've only done dimensional repairs, dimensional non-structural repairs.
Okay.
Somebody's got to mute their phone.
Yeah, someone, hello out there. If your phone's not muted, please mute it if you're not speaking. Hello. Well, they're obviously not listening. That's why they're
right.
And we can try to find that out on our line and mute their phone manually.
Okay.
I think it's NSA.
A lot of comments coming in about the background noise, and I apologize, folks. It's part of what we experience sometimes in this kind of forum. Okay, so with that, Fred, I thank you again for such a comprehensive presentation today and answering such good questions.
All right, thanks.
There'll be time at the end of today's forum to pick up any other questions that other folks may have, but we need to move on to our next speaker.
Okay, so Greg, I see we have Rob Robbie's presentation, so I assume we're going to be doing, okay.
Vic, this is Tim. I sent in a few slides. I didn't know if I'd have time to send them or not.
Oh, okay.
But if Rob's up, I can go after Rob.
Right. All right, so you heard that, Greg. So I guess Tim had some slides. I don't know if you guys have them. I don't, if you wanted to do that now, or if you wanted Rob to go right now.
So why don't we let Rob? I'm sorry, Tim. Why don't we get to Rob? Because we're running a little short on time, and we'll get back to ARL if time allows.
Okay. All right, very good. I'll do this very quickly. I'll introduce Rob Robbie. He's been instrumental in the development and, yep.
So, Rob, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I thought my phone went dead for a minute. Okay. I didn't know for sure. Is Brian James on as well?
I am.
Okay. So Brian and I are going to tag team on this brief. Brian is the Air Force Engineering Technical Services Lead at Ellsworth, and so he's been a key driver. We've been on the Air Force side and driving the development and application of cold spray kind of from the field level back through the depots and through the Air Force Material Command Headquarters. So it's been a big collaboration, and there's a slide in here that talks to that. So next slide, please. So Brian, if you want to take over the first couple of slides, and then I can talk to some of the other slides if you want.
Brian James.
Is everyone else getting him broken?
Yeah, I don't hear him at all. Over here, Rob.
Okay. Let me turn off, and maybe it's okay.
Yeah, I can hear you. You want me to just take it over?
Yeah, and I'll try calling back in.
Okay. Okay. Next slide, please. Okay, I'm going to talk through some of the Air Force application, and then some of the automation systems that Vic talked about, and then the portable system and some of the applications for that. Next slide. So on the Air Force side, it's been a kind of a large-scale collaboration, again, driven by field-level maintenance requirements. So there's a group that's been established at the headquarters material command level that has a weekly telecon where we try to discuss and adjudicate different applications. So everybody's involved, the material command, ACC, the depots, field level maintenance, contractors, universities, and so forth. We've also gotten Chief of Staff of the Air Force support for the cold spray program. So the Chief of Staff has made it, an emphasis item to, develop more cold spray applications across the Air Force. Next slide, please. This is kind of a slide that shows some of the applications, and I've got some individual slides that show these individually, but a lot of gearboxes, a lot of similar things to what Fred Lancaster was showing. Next slide. So this is an air inlet housing for the F-16. It's an aluminum casting. It's kind of a low-hanging fruit, not a lot of cost savings necessarily, but it's an aircraft availability issue. It's an inlet housing on the auxiliary power unit, so it's used on the ground only, so it's fairly non-controversial in terms of criticality of the component. We've done first article. We're doing additional testing and hoping to get that qualified here in the next month or two. Next slide. This is an F-15 airframe-mounted accessory drive gearbox housing, real similar to some of the things Fred, so the F-18 AMAD, it's similar in nature to that particular part. And I've got a video at the end of this that shows spraying one of these internal bores. So we're a lot of these internal bores on these things get have wear or corrosion or other damage that can be repaired. So we've done first article on this. It's in testing at Hill Air Force Base. This one is a really high return on investment, real expensive casting. I think it's in the $130,000 range per part. So pennies on the dollar for repair. Next slide, please. This is a slide that would show the video. This just shows the setup, and you'll see the video here in a little bit. It just shows some of the different bores that we repaired. And again, this was repaired at Moog's facility at Webster, Massachusetts. They have a couple of high-pressure systems there, and they're that Mantech system that we'll talk about a little bit is going to go into that facility. facility that Vic alluded to. Next slide. This is just another picture of the repair. Next slide. This is an F-16 accessory drive gearbox. Again, very complicated gearbox that has various wear and repair sites, very expensive. This one is has been nominated by Air Force Material Command and is currently entering into the qualification process. Next slide. Vic showed this, the automation project. Next slide. So this, I'm just going to explain a little bit more about this this project in a little more detail. Essentially what this is a six-axis CAD to motion system that's designed specifically for cold spray. So the idea, one of the problems with cold spray and one of the difficulties really is the development work associated with various geometries. You've seen a lot of these parts, and the reason I picked, some of the parts I did to show there were to show you some of the kind of complex geometries you get into. So what you need is a very high precision motion system to do some of those parts that can be done at a, you know, at a fixed location. So what this system will do is the gantry robot, you've got three axes of motion on the gantry, so it's got the Z-axis, pitch and yaw on the gantry, and it's got X, Y, and rotation on the table. And you'll see a video that kind of demonstrates the motion of it later on. It has a tool changer that allows you to, basically what you're going to be able to do with this system is chuck up a part. You'll be able to laser scan it, so scan it into SolidWorks. The whole system works off of, it's just a plug-in to SolidWorks. So you scan it into SolidWorks. You'll be able to do a non-destructive inspection using a UT sensor or a MWM sensor. Identify any corrosion or other damage. Then you will be able to pick up a mill or a grinder. And mill off any corrosion damage or other damage, blend it out, then go back and inspect the surface again, go in, cold spray the material back on, remachine it back to print, and do a final non-destructive inspection of the part. And if you want to do a final laser scan as well for dimensional analysis, you can. So you basically do a one-stop shop for a complete repair on a part. So what this system will do is help you in a lot of different ways in terms of not just production but development of the repairs. So you'll have all the capabilities you need to be able to, you know, redimensionalize a component with cold spray. And the great thing about it is you'll be able to actually utilize this system with other technologies other than cold spray in the future. So it's designed and developed for cold spray, but it has a lot more capabilities. Next slide. Next slide. Oh, okay. Go ahead and click through a couple of slides there. This just shows some of the details. It's got a basically a 5 foot by 4 foot by 2.5 foot envelope. Very high precision. Got about a 265 pound capacity. 3D air mapping. Next slide. Again, it can machine very high precision, accuracy down to 1 to 2 microns, repeatability 0.7 microns to 1 micron, so very highly accurate stages on this. Next slide. And again, that just shows all the different tooling attachments that you can attach to it. Next slide. This is the video, and it'll play at the end of the briefing. Next slide. Again, the big benefits to this is it provides you a flexible platform, and one of the things with cold spray, it's very dependent on geometry. So you know, Vic mentioned, 90 to 45 to the surface, but you do have to get into, it's line of sight, so you got to follow the contour, a 3D contour. So what this system will do is allow you to do that easily and develop your repair process. And it's accurate enough that you'll be able to do all the machining and redimensionalizing without having to send it out to a separate machine shop. For Sikorsky's, that UH-60 sump that was shown on there, it's basically a 90-day repair process. By the time you do your non-destructive inspection, you send it to a machine shop, they machine it, you re-NDI it, and then you send it somewhere else, cold spray, and so on and so forth. So that cuts it down to a day or two with this new system. Next slide. The other great thing about it is it'll allow you to just use a common system, operating system. Most people are familiar with SolidWorks, and it's just a plug-in add-on to SolidWorks, so it shows up as just a row of icons in there. So it can do additive or subtractive manufacturing. And again, this was an OSD Mantec project, and it'll be set up and running in Webster, Massachusetts in the February time frame. Should be checked out and fully operational by April or May. Next slide. This is the high-pressure portable system. One of the problems we've come across in the Air Force, and actually Fred Lancaster mentioned this, was the problem of accessing aircraft or field-level type maintenance. And so this system was specifically designed originally by ARL, and then we put additional controls on it. Basically, the innovation is that manifold that you see down on the lower hand left. Essentially, the heater is not part of the gun. So the gun itself is about the size of a 9mm pistol. So it's got a hose that can be reeled out about 10 feet towards the particular application. It's easily manipulated by hand, or you can take the little handle off there and manipulate it by a robot. You don't need near as big of a robot as you do with some of these other applications, because the other guns are, 20 to 40 pounds, I believe. So they're fairly bulky and fairly difficult to manipulate. And so this solves that problem. It's on a portable skid, so it's you can roll it right up to the aircraft, right onto the ship, wherever you need to get it, and then do your application from there.
Like I'm Rob said, this is I'm Brian James. I was able to get back on. I hope I'm scratchy anymore. Like he was stating, that a manifold allows us in the Air Force to be able to use this on piece of equipment right on vehicle. If the heater assembly was in the gun, we would not be able to put that onto a loaded aircraft with either on fuel or with ammunition. So having a sublocated or a geographically separated heater away from the gun affords us the ability to do it on vehicle, which is the innovative part that we really needed to have. Next slide. And then on this one, Rob, did you? We're going to wait.
Yeah,
for the
video. The video is going to show up at the end, I believe. So just go to the next slide, and I think they've got the, you can talk through the FEV panel.
Absolutely. On the B-1, like most of the legacy systems, like we discussed in the Navy and the Army, we have a parts availability issue. The B-1 is a maintenance-intensive aircraft, and at the date of a manufacturer, they produced 100 aircraft with very limited supplies, or very limited of replacement LRUs and structural panel. So what we found ourselves with the new ops tempo that we're doing, there's, to give you an example, the ops tempo on the B-1, since the start of second half or Gulf War, since 2002, there's been an aircraft, there's been on a B-1 in the air, 24 hours a day up to now. And with that ops tempo and limited on parts availability, mostly I'm coming out of the aircraft that we've retired. We had to come up with an innovative way to increase our aircraft availability and our parts availability, and especially on the items that were previously unobtainable and unrepairable assets. And the FEV panel is one of those. Each panel is approximately $200,000 to $225,000 a piece. It's a hybrid panel with an aluminum outer skin of 2024 with a composite underlayment. So because of that, you cannot do any repairs on the aluminum outer skin with a standard fusion weld. It would cause the composite to overcure or to disbond or both. So what we end up having on these is the panel itself is open and closed almost on a daily basis, and underneath those are all the avionics equipment. And underneath that, what holds it in place is the steel on tri-air on fastener, and since the skin itself is aluminum, the opening and closing causes the holes to get elongated, and then once the elongation starts, we get corrosion built up there, and then we'll get damaged at that point. If there's four holes that in a row that have elongation, or 10% of the overall holes, then the panel is considered unserviceable. Next slide. So as you can see here, the only repair that we were able to do up to the innovation of using cold spray was put a doubler. And unfortunately, the doubler itself is destructive. You have to rivet them on, and the riveting and the drilling of the holes actually destroys the panel over time. You can only do that one or two times. It basically extends the service life for a few years, but that's about it. And since we didn't have any panels other than the ones in A-Mark, and unfortunately the panels are not really interchangeable, over the years the aircraft has expanded and contracted with pressurization and depressurization, plus the fact that we've over-G'd on some of them that you can't just swap them in and out. So we needed to come up with a repair process that would take care of or address the thermal issues with composite underlayment, be cost-effective, and be repeatable. And the use of cold spray was that solution. So you can see down at the lower left corner, you would have a fastener that would wear out the panel or wear out the fastener hole, and then corrosion would start. We then took, I don't think I have a picture that shows the repair afterwards, do we, Rob?
Just the lower right there is all. We don't have enough close, I guess.
On the lower right, that's the one, it's the panel after it's been, was refurbed. We came up with a way to find out the center location of each hole using a template. Then we would spray each hole with cold spray, bring them down to OEM specs, allow the fastener to be airfared again to the top of the panel, and then we would give the panel back to the Air Force. The Air Force would prime it and then repaint it. The total cost was under $5,000 for a $250,000 panel, so it has an extremely high ROI, or roughly saying 10-to-1 ROI or a percent ROI of over $5,000. Next slide. The other item that we used, in fact, was a proof of concept used on cold spray on the B-1 or within the Air Force, was the one on the right side, the little curlicue, is a nose landing gear accumulator line. The line itself requires a special mandrel to be able to make those radiuses, but was unavailable at the time. So we got authorization and the help of the Army Research Lab on Dick Champagne. He came up and figured out a formula to use on CP tie to spray those. He was able to spray that one. We put it on in 2009. It became a permanent repair. And I say repair, it's not a we don't want to use this as a repair of chafed hydraulic lines. They're out of spec. This is only if it has not exceeded its chafing limit for the wall thickness, then we can spray back onto it, and that was the case on this one. It had not exceeded its chafe limit. So we sprayed the material back on it, reinstalled it on the aircraft, and it's got about 3,700 hours now on it. And then as a proof of concept, that was in 2009. In 2011, we chose two specific areas that were easy to remove the line that were on B-nut to B-nut. That was the one in the middle is the main break on the main landing gear, and then the one on the left side is the spoiler actuator line. Both of those, we removed them. We sent them out to Vic. He sprayed them for us. We reinstalled, and then part of my duties are to go into combat with the unit, so we deploy with them. So I went with these two aircraft and measured them on a daily basis and basically did a accelerated wear test. The aircraft will clock off 1,000 flight hours about every month, maybe a little on quicker than that, about a month, I guess. They'll fly on 14 hours, come down. If there's no expendables, munitions or chaff, then we'll just put on gas, switch out the crew, and then launch the jet again. And there was no noticeable wear on either of those items. And since that point, it's really gotten the attention of the Chief of Staff. General Hostage, ACC, is also very interested in using this as a way to increase his aircraft availability, reduce his maintenance man hours. On the B-1, I'm not sure if Rob discussed it, it was the number one NMC driver for us. In fact, it takes the next three to even equal the amount of time we spend replacing these lines. So if I can extend the service life of these lines, even one inspection cycle, there's a huge return of reduced NMC time and aircraft availability time. Next slide. Next slide. This would be the overall for the candidates that we picked within the B-1 would be the eight panels, the forward equipment bay panels. We're really close to getting that as a routine, as an authorized routine repair. We've been working with Dr. Cole out of the Air Force Material Command. We have weekly on telecon to address any of the issues that we need to work out between the Air Force Research Lab, the South Coast School of Mines and Technology, and the Army Research Lab to address any of the issues that we need to make everybody happy to approve this as a permanent repair for our skin panels. For this, on the forward equipment bay panel, the 52s have shown a lot of interest in wanting to have their skin panels also repaired. They have the exact same problem with the elongation of holes with obsolete panels. And again, the other one with the chafed hydraulic lines, that one has gotten a lot of visibility and a lot of support to see that expanded into doing a nose-to-tail on one to two aircraft. We have a program called a Chafing Awareness Program. It's mandated by ACC to document every area with inside of a weapon system that might have a known chafing area, record those, and then so we can take special notice of those areas in the future. So what we would like to do is to take that program, take the lessons learned from that, and find everywhere that's unfeasible to use cold spray to spray those lines, hold the jet down for 3 months, and hopefully that would be able to extend the service life of that aircraft by years, and not have to have the field maintainers go back into those known areas again. So, did you want to add anything to that, Rob?
No, just that the goal of that is to be able to do that on vehicle so that you can, if you had some chafing, you could go in there, touch it up a little bit, and not have to cut the lines out and re-swedge new lines in there. And it's also, it's not so much a cost issue in terms of the lines themselves, it's just it's aircraft availability and downtime, and that really dwarfs the cost of the part.
Yeah, most of the lines that are underneath the engine itself have names based upon how long they take to replace, the 5-day line, the 6-day line, the 15-day line. And we go into those on every aircraft that comes back from the FOL. We have to remove almost every inch of that hydraulic tubing under there. The reason being is there's a lot of isolation boots down in that general area. We get sand, we'll get impregnated underneath those isolation boots, and then you add some bonding agent to it, some hydro, some grease, and then damn vibration of the motors just completely destroy the lines after that. And if we could extend the service life of those to where we could at least make it between our isochronal inspections, the reason we don't stop those during inspection cycles was the Air Force went from a phase hour inspection to an isochronal inspection, and unfortunately it does not afford us the opportunity to interrupt the chafing event before it becomes catastrophic to the line. So this is a great partnership with that. We're not going to be able to back up and change back to a phase hour inspection. It just was not cost effective. Flying a B-1 back and forth every 600 hours, if I'm clocking off 600 hours in a month, I'm flying jets back and forth at $1 million to pop. So
I think we're probably going to run out of time, so let's could we go to the video, or is there another slide in there? I think that's it. So this is just the F-15 AMAT. So this is actually a CGT cold spray system, but you're basically repairing an internal bore. Now this is the an earlier version of the Gen 3 portable system. So you can see it's about the size of a 9mm pistol. You can hand hold it. This is 5x speed, so the cold spray doesn't build up quite that fast. But you can see you can build up. You can fill a simulated corrosion hole or damage fairly quickly and efficiently. With this handheld system, just with a little bit of training in terms of this sort of like welding in terms of speed and standoff distance and angle. And then this material is then fully machinable, so you could machine it down or grind it down, whatever you need to do to get the surface back to dimension. So you can see the final product there. And then this is the Mantec system, just shows you the kind of tool changer, the motion system. This is demonstrated on a CGT system that's on there right now with the UH-60 sump. It'll give you the capability to manipulate, spray in different areas, spray over contours. go get different tools and, you know, do all the operations in a one-stop shop kind of operation. I think that's it. I don't know if anybody has any questions or whether we have time or not.
So, Brian, we have a couple of questions here. And first of all, let me say, Brian and Rob, great presentation. Thank you for that. Very cool. Question number one, how much did the Air Force leverage previous work done by ARL and NAVAIR when developing and qualifying Air Force gearbox repairs?
It was completely, on the Air Force side, was completely leveraged, really, because the ESPCP program was primarily, I think, a Navy and Army, correct me if I'm wrong, Vic, but then almost all the lessons learned from that were rolled into the Air Force effort. So the Air Force actually kind of came on board late in the game in the cold spray, but we've been trying to ramp up pretty fast.
Okay, so as far as qualification testing and data, were you able to leverage all that? Were the materials the same, or did the Air Force have to go back in and come up with their own, you know, qualification tests and protocols and develop their own test data, or did they just leverage what NAVAIR and ARL had done on previous gearboxes?
We actually, in a lot of cases, had to redo the data. Not completely. We were able to leverage some of it. And, of course, we had the lessons learned from the previous programs, but then we had to go back and reprove that we could meet, you know, their standards. So they did their own testing with the Air Force Research Lab. And then, of course, there's individual qualifications for each part. So they didn't just accept the fact that the Navy was repairing a similar part. We had to basically retest it.
Okay. Who actually manufactured the Mantec cold spray automation machine that you showed in your video?
So my company, HF Webster Engineering, was the prime contractor for the motion system and the gantry. I had a team of basically a company called Bicommerce, or actually they go by Flexible Robotic Environment now, that actually did the software. And then Cybernet and did some of the peripheral integration. And then South Dakota School of Mines helped with some of the integration effort as well.
Okay. Here's a question. It's probably more of a dimensional type question, but it says, will the portable system fit through ship hatches? And I guess your answer is probably going to be, I don't know.
Well,
you're not a ship guy.
I'm not a ship guy, but I can. I've been on a ship before, and I don't. The current configuration will not. But we are working on a sort of narrowed down, smaller version that would that. In theory, could even go like on a submarine or something really small. I think it's clearly possible from the work we've done, it's possible. It's going to take a little more work to get it down small enough because the system as it sits now is right around 500 pounds because it's 1,000 PSI. 900 degree C system. So that what that forces you is into a lot of high pressure control valves and that sort of thing that are fairly heavy. But I believe that eventually here in the near future we're going to have a solution for a shipborne version that could be portable through relatively small hatches.
Okay. And the final question that we have, and I think it covers a couple different questions above, was how was the B1's FEB panel repair qualified?
We were able to find out the qualification requirements from Oklahoma City ALC. They provided those for us. We submitted an ETAR, which is an engineering technical request, to them asking for authorization to do the repair. Once we came up with the test coupons, we then did the testing from the qualification requirements that were provided by Oklahoma City ALC Engineering, Sustained Engineering Group. And they received those either internally or from the OEM.
Was that you, Brian?
Yes.
Brian, can you comment on what those test parameters or requirements were?
Rob probably knows them. I'm better not. I didn't do the qualification. I'm testing. Rob did. And I'm doing this. Rob and Dick.
So they required adhesion testing, tensile testing. They wanted an elongation of 3% or greater. And we actually did a bearing load test, which was basically simulating the bearing load associated with the fasteners. And then standard porosity measurements and microscopy.
Okay. And with that ends the questions that we have. And again, I thank you, gentlemen, for spending the time to provide us with this information today. We're almost at 4 o'clock, and we're supposed to be ending at 4 o'clock today. I'm amenable to sticking around a little longer if you all are. So, Dick, I'll hear from you. Do you want to hear Penn State ARL? Do we have enough time for that?
Yeah.
As wrap up?
Yeah, I think we should. I think we should. Tim's present, and he's got a few applications that, again, it's all applications, and test data. So I think we should hear that, and, he'll run through it quick, and then we can wrap it up.
Okay, and Tim, this is Greg again. I would just, there's some things in here that, in your presentation, that have been gone over already in either Fred's presentation or in Vic's presentation previously. Perhaps if you could skip to slide 86 and go forward from 86, those to me look like things we haven't talked about yet today.
Greg, can you tell me what the title is of that? Because we don't have it by number like that.
Self-lubricating coatings applied by cold spray. That's slide 86. That's it.
11 on
top. Just quick introduction. Dr. Tim Eden from Pennsylvania State University works, with us through the years, actually right from when the technology was introduced into the United States. So go ahead, Tim. Huh. Is Tim not there?
I'm here.
Okay. One of the things I just want to, thank everybody for the opportunity, try to be quick. Penn State ARL is a university-affiliated research center. We've been designated a center of excellence by the Navy. One of the areas that we, working with the cold spray, we get Mantec funding through our IMAST, Institute for Manufacturing and Sustainment Technology program. And so we work with people in the, mainly in the Navy to identify problems, and that's how our RepTech work got with, Fred. And, we've done a lot of work with Vic. One of the things that, they showed some of the repairs that we've worked on in a joint program, and we work with a lot of, faculty members and students to, advance cold spray. We have a self-lubricating coating that we put down where we encapsulate hexagonal boron nitride in a nickel coating, and we're able to apply that. We get really good adhesion strength. We've reduced the coefficient of friction, and this is would be to eliminate like fretting fatigue. And the target was for the blades into a disc. If you want to go to the next slide. And then just we do a lot of characterization to support some of the S&T objectives that the Navy put out. We do powder, you know, very detailed powder analysis we need to. We do tribology, corrosion, thermal cycling. You can see all those things that we do. And one of the things that we do is we have students do these projects. And we've had a number of undergraduate, master's, and PhD-level students working on cold spray projects, and some of those have been hired by industry and the government to continue their work in that area. Next slide. That's just the corrosion capabilities that we have. And we'll go to the next slide. And we started looking at different methods for NDE, seeing that how you could inspect the interface between the coating and the substrate, and also how you could do a bulk inspection of the coating to using ultrasound to see if you have voids in the process. And this was a plate that we made. I did the dye penetrant inspection on it, our ultrasonic setup. If you want to go to the next slide. And then that's just images of the inspection that we did with the ultrasonic. Found out that we needed two different frequency methods, if you will, to look at the back, you know, the interface between the coating and the substrate, and also to look at the bulk substrate. And we got some good images and showed that we had really good coating performance. And if you want to go to the next slide. And we do cost modeling, and this is an example of a student project where we went in and we have some software that's set up, and you can put in, and you can put in all the parameters you want. You can have a burden, you can do your consumables, your equipment amortization, however you want, and then that way you can go in and calculate the costs, and you can use this to back out a deposition efficiency. And this was done by a student as a senior project, and we've made this available. So I tried to be quick, get it done close to 4 o'clock. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, I want to reiterate is the Mantech project is we get funding from the Navy. We submit projects, and Kurt Daner's been involved in this with our RepTech projects, and we submit them to them, make sure that it meets an ROI, and then we can bring funding to the table when we work with different groups to solve their problems. And we've had 3 or 4 different cold spray projects, and one of them was early on where we did a coating on the AAV armor, sent it out for a couple of year-long deployments, and it came back, and both of those coatings, or the coatings worked very well, and they were on steel, and we didn't have to have a really high adhesion. We just needed to provide a corrosion barrier for them. So that was pretty quick. You know, and again, we worked with a number of people. So go ahead.
Yeah, much appreciated, Tim, and thanks for being sensitive to the time. And again, sorry for running out of time on you for this one. Is anybody using this cost model? This is this is kind of unique in a way where you put a cost model together against a process like cold spray. Do you know of anybody using this for making business decisions on whether to use cold spray or not?
We just got this released so that we could send it out, and I've sent out a copy to a couple of, I think Pratt Whitney has a copy, but we use it routinely when we do our, like if we support an SBIR, and I guess in that case it is, that we use that to develop the cost estimates and to show the, you know, is it worth it, you know, what it would cost to do a coating. And then we have it set up so that you can put in your own labor rate, your own burden rate, so that, because I know that's a competitive advantage for, you know, a lot of people consider that a competitive advantage.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
So if somebody wants the software, they can request it, and we can get that out to them.
Okay. And we have another question here. It says, how thick is the anti-fret coating on the airfoil fir tree that you discussed before?
What we usually, well, in our testing, we, you know, we've put it on a stick as a quarter of an inch, and then we've machined it back to, you know, to a few thousandths of an inch, just depending on the application. So there's not a specific number right now.
Okay. So, yeah, okay, so from a tolerance perspective, it's pretty tight in that area already, so there's not really a whole lot of room for those things.
So,
okay.
Yeah, and I don't, we have done that, and I don't recall that number, but, you know, you can machine the coating down to, you know, whatever thickness that you want, because it machines very well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is there, have you seen any appreciable benefits over traditional anti-fret coatings used in those areas?
No, we just, you know, our fretting tests that we've done in the tribology area show that there's improvement. And what we've done in the past is they put a solid lubricant on the top of the coating, and that works very well. And when that solid lubricant goes away, then it just wears down through the coating. And this way we have lubricant all the way through the coating, and we just got this developed, and we haven't been able to get it back into to an engine test to show how it would work in, under a simulated environment.
Okay. And that are the only questions that we had from your presentation. And again, I thank you for your sensitivity to our time. And with that, it is a little after 4 at this point. So, Vic, I'll ask you for your closing remarks, and then I'll make mine.
Sure. So, obviously, I want to, you know, thank Greg and the JTAG for the opportunity to collaborate. I do want to, you know, state that announcements will be coming out for the Cold Spray Action Team. The next get-together will be at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, and that's in Worcester, Massachusetts, and that will be June 18th and 19th of 2014. And, you know, I hope today, you know, because I was instrumental in getting a lot of the speakers here, I'm hoping that it provided a good venue, you know, for people to go back and chew on this stuff and to come up with a, you know, an opportunity to collaborate on whatever, you know, project or program that we deem is feasible. And one of the things that I want to put forward is that, you know, in coming up with a particular project or program theme, I would probably think about centering it around a particular widespread application, you know, kind of like I did for the ESTCP. You pick a project or an application, rather, that has widespread usage throughout, for instance, those magnesium aerospace components. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, Greg.
Yeah, and again, I'll reiterate what Vic said. I just want to thank everybody here for spending, you know, in excess of 3 hours with us today talking about a sustainment and maintenance capability that has unbelievable potential across not only Department of Defense, but also can revolutionize maintenance and industry as well as manufacture. I think we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg. We're scratching the surface as far as the applications for cold spray across the board. And I'm excited about what I've heard today from the Army, from the Air Force, and from NAVAIR, as well as, you know, what's taking place at IMAST at Penn State. And I really look forward then to continuing a partnership between our Joint Technology Exchange Group and the Cold Spray Action Team. And by that partnership, I'm hoping to drive maybe some more holistic or more joint kind of interaction between, you know, these groups of people that really want to drive cold spray forward more effectively, more efficiently, and more expeditiously. specific thanks to Vic and Fred and Brian, Rob and Tim, and a shout out to NCMS again for really putting together a fantastic technical virtual venue for us to collaborate within. So again, thanks to Debbie and Matt and the crew at NCMS for, again, a job well done facilitating this today. You know, when we have these forums, I always walk away with more questions than I went in with, because I feel like I'm a little smarter about the capability, so that the questions just kind of flow for me. And when I start to look at the kinds of things that might facilitate or enable wider adoption across the department or better sharing of capabilities, I ask myself the question, you know, where's the body of knowledge for all of the good work that's been done in Cold Spray up to this point across the department? We've seen lots and lots of examples of Cold Spray in development, Cold Spray in application, Cold Spray now in operations. And I'm wondering, you know, how can we better leverage all that work that's been done other than reaching out to the smartest people that we know in DOD, which are here on the phone today and briefed us here today on what they've done and what they've been able to accomplish. So there might be there's opportunities here, I think, to do the Martian mind meld with Vic and with Fred and with Brian and with Tim and with Rob and try to then take this body of knowledge and put it someplace where it's accessible to the community at large, so that we can, again, facilitate more sharing, more leveraging of prior work that's been done, and we can talk about what that would entail. But maybe, you know, what we could do is we could talk about that between now with the CSAT team and the time that we get together in June, in the middle of June, at the Worcester Polytechnical Institute, and see whether or not that particular idea has any credence or will resonate with the crowd. There's other areas as well that we talk about. We talked a lot about the qualification requirements. We talked about all the different test parameters, but we're really talking about, you know, how do we best take this capability now and apply it to a whole range of applications that may prove beneficial to the department. So things like, you know, some guidance, you know, a guidebook on Cold Spray is an idea. Standard qualification framework for Cold Spray applications, various Cold Spray applications. More joint kind of taking the individual technology development roadmaps and having more maybe of a joint recognized technology roadmap that will help us, again, to obtain the resources required to, again, drive that or make that roadmap a reality. And then roadmaps on the technology, the transition of the technology, things like, you know, qualification, specs and standards. Are we done with specs and standards? I don't know. But they're the kind of questions that kind of roll through my head as we go through these forums. And I think they're the kinds of what I'll call big muscle movements that I'd like to see, you know, us pick up as a joint community to start to look at where are those leverage points, what are those big muscle movements that may now enable or may facilitate, again, wider adoption of Cold Spray technologies more expeditiously or more efficiently than perhaps we're doing it today. So that's, you know, that's really my closing is it's more questions than answers. I certainly appreciate everybody coming forth today and telling us what they're doing. We can all see the potential, but I think there's so much potential here for us to work jointly and collaboratively that I'd really like to then start to explore some of those big muscle movements with the Cold Spray Action Team, with the NAVAIR team, with the Air Force, under hopefully a cohesive team, perhaps being under the Cold Spray Action Team as that joint team. Does that make sense, Vic?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'll throw out a particular theme, and we're already starting it already, but structural applications in general, and just pick a material substrate combination that would be, you know, have some widespread applicability across the DoD and commercial sector, because that's basically the next big step, you know, and in the advancement of the technology.
Okay, that sounds like a great idea. And I guess with that, you know, Vic, we'll look forward to interfacing with your cold spray action team on a regular basis, working our way up to the 18-19 forum, so that we have a cohesive agenda that looks like a joint agenda,
right?
That we can move, you know, in the June timeframe.
Absolutely. Very good.
Okay. And with that, we're out here. Thanks again, everybody.
Wait, hold on. I just want to say two things. Just want to let everyone know that we will be sending out a link within the next 2 days that includes all the briefs that were presented today, including the video and the list of participants. We're also going to disseminate the questions to all the speakers to ensure that we have answers for everything. And we'll also disseminate those to everyone as well.
Okay, thanks, Deb.
Yeah.
Sorry about missing that.
No worries.
All right, and we're only, after all that, we're only 13 minutes over. So, again, appreciate your time.
All right, thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, thanks, Greg.
Yeah.
Bye, everyone.
There's Yogi.